Well, good morning, and thank you for being here. This is a Public Utilities Commission organized forum, but we are really impressed with the level of interest from across the various industries, real people, legislators, media. We got a lot of folks here. I'm Dusty Johnson up here as well, our commissioners Steve Kolbeck and Gary Hansen. I think any of us who read the newspapers understand that if you had to pick three defining issues of the current administration, what the administration would like the defining issues to be, I think it's economic recovery, it's health care, and it's climate change. And what role should carbon play going forward, and how do we get from here to there? We are not climatologists, the three of us. We are economic regulators, not environmental regulators. And so our interest in this comes from a little bit different area. I mean, I don't think you're going to be seeing a lot of screenshots of polar bears or ice caps or climatological data. I think the focus is going to be, as important as that stuff is, I don't want to minimize it, but as important as that is, the discussion today is a little bit different. The discussion today is who's going to pay? What policy mechanism is most likely to come from Washington? What is the effect going to be on the families and businesses that pay those bills? And that information, I think, is valuable for two reasons. First off, so that we can begin to prepare. If the economic impact is going to be X, I think it's helpful for people to know that in advance so that they can begin to build business plans and personal decisions around that information. But then secondly, if there are tweaks that could be made to a mechanism, a policy mechanism, to mitigate some of the effects on families and businesses, to make it as effective as it can be while having the lowest possible negative impact, I think it's incumbent upon all of us to engage in some advocacy to make sure that we get it right. No matter what any of our personal views are on climate change legislation, I think we all agree that the worst possible outcome is bad climate change legislation. Which is not effective, but that does cause some negative impacts on real people. We can't introduce everybody, but I do want to take some time to introduce a few important folks in the audience today. First off, we've got a number of legislators, very busy folks, glad that they're here, and I'll go ahead and read off their names and if they can stand, and then we'll recognize them at the end. We've got Representative Todd Schleckaway, Representative Daryl Solberg, Representative Lance Carson, Representative Manny Steele, Representative Susie Blake, Senator Mike Valley. Did I miss anyone? Thanks very much for coming. We appreciate that. We've got a representative from our congressional staff, and I don't know if I saw them all, but I know they'll be, if they're not here now, they'll be here shortly. Mark Gerhart from Hearst Sandlin's office, Matt Asselford from Senator Johnson's office, Ben Reddy from Senator Thune's office. Thanks very much. Your bosses obviously play a huge role in this stuff going forward, so thanks. And then we're especially grateful to have Tony Rogers, the Executive Director of the Rosebud Public Utilities Commission, and we've got a great working relationship with that Utilities Commission, and really appreciate the professionalism that Tony and his commissioners bring to the work they do. So we're all in this together, certainly. So with that, let's go ahead and get to the people who know what they're talking about, certainly more than I do. Our first presenter today is Chris Malay, who's become a dear friend. Our national association is NARUC, the National Association of Regulatory Utility Commissioners. Chris is a legislative guru for more than 20 years. He has been a go-to guy on Capitol Hill working in that arena. He's got experience working for senators and working for associations. His real area of expertise for him recently has been what is going to be happening, what is likely to happen with some of this climate change regulation and carbon in general. Without any further ado, Chris, please take it away.
Thank you so much for the kind words, Commissioner, and I want to thank you for inviting me. I've been pestering Commissioner Johnson for a long time to get to South Dakota because it's one of the, I think I had five states that I haven't been to yet and wanted to check it off, but I was hoping he would turn the heat on at least by the time I had gotten here. So thank you again for the invite. Quite honestly, anybody that would stand up here and say they know what's going on with regard to climate legislation in Congress is either telling a fib or as trying to confuse themselves as well as others. What I'm going to try to do is not give you predictions. Predictions are for soothsayers and the like. But I'm going to try to give you the remarks from the angle of handicapping or betting. If I were going to be placing a bet, here's where I would be putting my money on how things are going to work out. And as we all know, especially if you've looked at my bracket in the NCAA, those of us that bet don't win all the time. So we are wrong quite often. But, you know, that's the nature of handicapping. Let me kind of set out what I have seen happening over the last, I want to say, 18 months or so, and give you an idea of where I think we're looking at going in Congress. There are a number of dynamics that have occurred that you're all aware of. I'm not going to get into the elections. One outcome of the election I do want to bring up, because it fundamentally changed the likelihood of seeing action on an energy bill in general, and a carbon bill or a greenhouse gas bill, climate change bill, call it what you wish, in particular. And that was with the huge gains that the Democrats made in the House. There was a power struggle on the House Energy and Commerce Committee, and that occurred prior to the start of the session. The former chair of the Commerce Committee was a man by the name of John Dingell, had been the chair longer than most of us in this room have been alive. He was truly one of the old bull chairmen. He was deposed, if you will, by Congressman Henry Waxman from California. Mr. Dingell was not a big fan of carbon legislation. Okay, he came from Michigan. His auto workers were a big part of his constituency. He had committed all along to do something, but he was going to do it slowly, and he was going to do it, in his words, methodically. And Mr. Waxman, coming from California, wanted to move much quicker. Speaker of the House Pelosi wanted to move much quicker, and you had a power struggle, and Mr. Waxman won the vote, and Mr. Dingell was no longer chairman of the committee. Chairman of the committee sets the agenda at the committee, and to a large extent, he or she can buck the leadership. Now that you have Mr. Waxman there, we're pretty well guaranteed that he's going to move on that quickly. As a matter of fact, he said, has been saying, that he wants to have an energy bill and carbon legislation out of his committee by the Memorial Day recess. So that I just want to give you that was a pretty fundamental change in the way Congress was looking at this issue. Let me step back a little bit, and I will come back to the House in a second. But there's a number of things going on out there that are all sort of part of this moving puzzle. The Obama administration obviously wants to have a carbon regime in place. They would rather have it sooner than later. One of the big reasons they want to move quickly on it is because of the upcoming meeting in December, which I think is in Denmark. Copenhagen. Yeah, Copenhagen, which is sort of the rebirth of Kyoto to try to get an international regime together. And the administration desperately wants to have some paper that they can take with them to that meeting. So that gives you a timing scenario there. To try to meet that goal and prod Congress to move forward, just last week, EPA came out with advanced rulemaking, I guess is the term. It still has to go through OMB and everyone else. And I'm not going to give you the really correct term of art that they use, but they basically played the card to make carbon a harmful pollutant under the Clean Air Act, which means if the regulation goes forward, conceivably the agency could do this unilaterally without congressional input. That's the threat, if you will, to move Congress forward. I don't think anybody wants to see EPA put a carbon regime in. Most people are saying, you know, it should be in the legislature. But be that as it may, that's another piece that's out there that just happened. The other piece that's out there right now is in Mr. Obama's budget, his first one. One of the basic assumptions in that budget is that a cap and trade regime will raise something on the order, you know, over the course of the timeline, $645 billion, you know, some say seven, some say six, so let's say $6.5 billion that would go into the federal treasury, and that's a pretty large chunk in his budget assumptions. That almost necessitates Congress acting, and they're going to be doing the budget this week, and we'll have to wait and see if they have left that in there or changed it to some extent. But it also has another implication. As many of you are aware, in the United States Senate right now, you can't really get anything done without 60 votes. The 51 vote threshold doesn't pertain to too many pieces of legislation any longer unless they've been agreed to. With the exception of budget reconciliation. And budget reconciliation is a process that will be coming down the pike probably in the early summer, maybe late fall, where they take the budget and then they readjust it. During budget reconciliation, there is a stipulation in the Budget Act that says you can't filibuster it. So it's strictly a 51-vote situation. One of the options, and it's been used by Republicans as well as Democrats, one of the options that the majority does is try to put policy pieces on the budget reconciliation process. There is a rule called the Byrd Rule, which says, in essence, it has to be A, germane, and it has to be dealing with revenue. It can't be an extraneous policy position. But that's largely up to the parliamentarian when they come up as to whether or not the rule is invoked, and then there's a vote, et cetera, et cetera. But I throw that out there to let you know that there is a process by which that 60 vote threshold can be lowered to 51. Now that's very, very important in the Senate, and the Senate staff that's sitting here know this already. I'm probably putting them to sleep, but it's something you must consider in the formulation. At this point in time, my opinion only, and it's not the opinion of my membership, my association, my leadership, my boss's dog, his cattle, whatever, it's just mine. They don't have the votes in the Senate right now to pass any cap and trade regime. It's just not there. And when I say they don't have the votes, they don't have 60 votes. They're probably close. It would have to be a pretty, in my opinion, watered down cap and trade proposal to get the 60 votes. Having said that, I don't think there's any problem with the Environment and Public Works Committee moving a cap and trade bill out of committee. I think that's a pretty easy lift. Senator Boxer's the chair; she has the votes in committee. The problem for her will be, quite frankly, on the floor of the Senate. The Senate will probably take up an energy bill next week. It'll be a very slimmed down energy bill. Things like appliance standards, water resources for energy projects, and workforce issues. The Senate is looking like they want to do what the House is suggesting, whereas before the Senate was going to do an energy bill and then a climate bill and do them separately. The House was always looking at doing an energy bill and a climate bill together. I think the Senate and the House, or the leadership at least, is looking trying to do the same thing in both chambers. So what that means is you're going to have this small energy bill that they're going to do next week to gather some momentum. And then after the two-week recess that's coming up, you'll have the big energy components, RPS, transmission, and probably not climate, because in the Senate, climate legislation is in a different committee than the vast majority of the energy proposals. The energy proposals go through the Energy and Natural Resources Committee. Climate has to go through EPW. So they'll have to merge that on the floor. And quite frankly, in the Senate, markups in committee are fairly benign. Most of the fight, most of the work is done on the floor. Whereas in the House, the fight is done in the committee, because it's the only place the minority party gets any hearing. The House is the perfect democracy. Majority rules, minority doesn't matter. But there's an interesting dynamic in the House committee with regard to climate, and that is, I think Mr. Waxman's going to have a tougher lift in committee than he will on the floor. If he gets it out of committee, he's got it on the floor. That's not a heavy lift at all. But he will have a little bit of difficulty on his committee, just because he's got a number of oil patch Democrats. He's got a number of Democrats that won election that are considered swing districts, or at least moderate Democrat, conservative Republican districts. So the low-hanging fruit that they picked off may not be easy for him to turn. I've kind of rushed through what the political field of play is. There are a number of pieces of legislation out there that I think everybody needs to be aware of. We have not, as of yet, seen a new climate bill. It is being drafted. I have not seen anything out of Mr. Waxman's committee in the House. I am told that a draft will be out on the 31st, which will be the discussion draft for the House side. I don't have any information on when Ms. Boxer is trying to get her bill out, but I stress that it's going to be a really heavy lift in the Senate. If I were betting, given the economy, I've been wrong before, but my money is going on the side that I don't think they can get a climate bill out of the Senate this year, and probably not next. So we're probably looking at either the next Congress, and it would have to be done in the first year, because as you know, once the midterm elections are done, then everybody starts focusing on the presidential. So I think they'd have to get it done in that first year. Failing that, obviously it would look like first year in if Mr. Obama were to win re-election in his second term. And that can change. Obviously, my prognostication could change with the wind, depending on what happens and what various pieces of legislation look like. Having said that, does that mean we can all sit back and not worry about it and not prepare for a climate-constrained federal government system? Absolutely not. It's coming. The question is when, and the question is how. There's a lot of talk, believe it or not, because as they get into the nuts and bolts of cap and trade, it becomes very, very difficult. There's a lot of knots that need untying. So you're starting to hear various individuals talk about, instead of a cap and trade, let's just go to the simplified version and do a strict carbon tax. Now, those two words were four-letter words for a long, long time, you know, carbon tax. But when you look at the proposals that we've been hearing about, the cap and trade is generally being thought of now as just that anyway. So let's just do a strict carbon tax. It's easier. It's quicker. We can do it faster. I don't know if that's going to happen. I would say that would be a pretty tough political nut to crack right now. But so what we're looking at is some cap and trade regime moving forward. I would suspect that it's going to look similar to what the Lieberman-Warner bill looked like as far as the cap-and-trade mechanism. The big question we are all trying to figure out is, how is it going to be done? Are there going to be free allowances? And if there are going to be free allowances in the in-years, who do they go to? My association has a standing position that should Congress decide to do cap-and-trade, and should they decide to provide for free allowances, that those allowances ought go to the LDCs so that commissions have the ability to look at those at the transactions and can have a determination as to how that money is used.
Chris, tell folks what LDCs are.
Oh, the local distribution companies. I'm sorry. As opposed to going to the generators. Because if you recall in Lieberman-Warner, it was a kind of a convoluted situation where in the in-years, there were a lot of free allowances. The lion's share of them went to the generators with, I think, 9% to the local distribution entities, and that went up gradually to 10 or 11%. So at this point, individuals like Mr. Markey, who chairs the subcommittee under Mr. Waxman, he does not want to see any free allowances. He wants an auction-only regime. There's a lot of support for that in a lot of areas of both the Senate and the House. The big, I guess, philosophical, more so than political, debate on that is, on the one side, those that want free allowances want the free allowances to cushion the economic blow on all the ratepayers. And when I'm talking about ratepayers for this portion, I'm talking about the three customer classes, not just residential, not just commercial, not just industrial. I'm talking about all customer classes. So when I use the word consumer or ratepayer, I'm not focused on the retail only. So the free allowances would be to cushion the blow, if you will. Now, those that don't want free allowances argue that that defeats the purpose. You need to have an economic signal to modify behavior, in essence. And I'm not going to sit here and tell you which one's right, which one's wrong. You all have your opinions on that. So those are kind of where the battle lines are drawn. And with that, I think I'm just about out of my time, and I'd be delighted to answer questions now or after Karen is done. And, you know, there's a lot of other moving parts, and I hope we do have some questions because I just, you know, we just don't have enough time in our comment period to cover it all.
We'll certainly ask some questions, but let's hear from Karen first. We are very honored to have Karen Bridges. She is an attorney with the Environmental Law and Policy Center. She's out of Minnesota. Also, like Mr. Melee, has some experience on the Hill, worked for Senator Baucus. Really, and her area of expertise has been on the sorts of issues we're talking about today. So very glad to have you here, and take it away, Karen.
As he said, my name is Karen Bridges. I'm a staff attorney with the Environmental Law and Policy Center. I'm very pleased to be invited to speak at this forum. I think it's really very important that the Public Utilities Commission is having this discussion, because as they noted at the beginning, the worst thing that could happen would be a bad cap-and-trade bill, and I don't think I'm going to argue against that. And one of the ways to get good policy and good legislation is to gather good information, specific information about how these policies are going to impact the people that you work with and regulate. So I very much appreciated what you had to say there. And I definitely appreciate Chris's expertise and what he had to say about what's may or may not be going on in the Hill. And I don't think I can add very much to that because I can't prognosticate on that any better than you can. I was specifically asked to address the why of global warming legislation. Maybe less why is it coming than why is it important, and why is it important to have this kind of discussion today, and why do we need it? Why is it important? And I think as the Midwest governors, as some of you may know, how it came together on a set of a greenhouse gas accords, which I believe South Dakota is an observer to. And, you know, they made some pretty good statements on this, I think. One of them being that we basically know enough about climate change that the time to act is now, and it's certainly the cost of inaction is great. It could possibly be catastrophic in certain parts of the world. So we do know enough to act. But they also looked at it in a very positive way and said for the Midwest, addressing climate change will create new economic opportunities, produce economic growth and jobs by maximizing the region's low-carbon energy production and by providing opportunities for the Midwest manufacturing and service sectors to supply low-carbon technologies and know-how to the region and the world. And I think that's a really good way to look about what may or may not be happening with climate change legislation nationally, regionally, globally. I mean, this really is, again, as I think the commissioners noted at the beginning, this is the political and economic reality that we have to deal with now. And the question is, how do we take advantage of this reality? How do you thrive in it? I guess, take most advantages of the benefits that can come from this kind of legislation for a state like South Dakota. Chris has mentioned some of the things that are coming down the pike, like actions by the EPA. EPA is likely to make, I think the term that you were
searching for
is an endangerment finding.
That's the one.
That they're going to find that greenhouse gases do endanger public health and welfare, which means that they're going to act to regulate greenhouse gas emissions regardless of what Congress does. They're, you know, I mean, obviously, with any regulation, there'll be a lengthy time frame in terms of hearings and what kind of regulations they're talking about. Surely there will be litigation, as there always is. The Northeast, the Midwest, as I mentioned, and the West have all developed their own regional greenhouse gas initiatives. And at least in the Northeast, that has actually already led to restrictions on greenhouse gas emissions and allowance auctions that have raised hundreds of millions of dollars for those states. So, and again, as Chris alluded to, there are intense negotiations going internationally about a new international agreement that's going to culminate in December in Denmark. And again, as he mentioned, the administration very much wants to show up there with something in hand to show that the United States is serious about acting on this. So again, this is, and the bottom line is that the policy changes to regulate and put a price on greenhouse gases are coming, and at the very least, a state like South Dakota is going to be indirectly impacted by these changes, even if the state itself does nothing or doesn't join an accord, or there it could be, you know, depending on the, how many years it takes Congress to get a bill passed. And again, I think the positive way to look at this is how do you benefit from this scenario? And I think even absent concerns about global warming, most people can agree that it's the time is long past for some serious investment and upgrades in the nation's energy delivery system, that it's always a good thing to continually diversify our energy sources to become more efficient and to develop new energy technologies that reduce business costs, that are good for the environment, and then increase our national security. No matter what you think about the realities or not of global warming, these are all important side benefits that would come with any greenhouse gas regulations. There will be costs to regulation, and there's no doubt about that, and I think we'll hear a lot more about that with the other presenters. But the thing about costs is that they can be managed and they can be offset. And that's one of the beauties of cap and trade even a carbon tax, but I'm certainly not an expert on that. I'm not going to get into the various economic benefits of one versus the other. But at least under cap and trade regime, in theory, it does harness part of the power of the market. It encourages innovation to find the most efficient path to reductions. an example I know a lot of people always use is the acid rain program, which cost far less than anybody had ever anticipated. It drove technological innovation and was very successful. I mean, it was one of those few environmental regulations that cost far less than anybody had anticipated and achieved its goals earlier than anticipated as well. And that tends to be something that happens when we try to predict or model what's going to happen with environmental regulations over time. They often tend to cost far less than what we had predicted at the outset when those are actually implemented. And they also have to look at, you know, the longer you wait to address something, the costs are always going to rise. But, you know, the later you wait, the more expensive it's going to be to address the problem in the future. When you look at some of the modeling that's been done on the cost of cap and trade legislation, again, it's something that's very hard to do. It's hard to capture all the various inputs that go into that modeling. But one of the things that a lot of the various models can tell us, including those from the Energy Information Administration, is that the greater the investment that's made in new energy technologies like carbon capture and storage, renewable energy technologies, energy efficiency, those can have a dramatic impact on the cost of a cap and trade program. If you are somewhat generous in your estimates of what's going to happen with these technologies, if you look out to 2030, for example, under one scenario that the energy information talks about, GDP will grow at 184% under a business as usual scenario, and it will grow at 183% under a cap and trade regime. So essentially, no difference in impact in overall GDP over time. If we do a good job about, again, going back to crafting a good legislation incorporating serious investments in next-generation energy technologies and making sure that we are smart about what cost containment provisions that we include in such a bill. Another policy that's out there that could impact the overall cost of a cap-and-trade bill include, say, a renewable electricity standard. An aggressive renewable electricity standard, which is projected to benefit South Dakota very much, much to the consternation of some folks in the South. Over time, the Energy Information Administration has predicted that will have a significant impact on reducing the cost of natural gas over time. I know that's one of the concerns about the cost of cap and trade bill is the potential impact it could have on natural gas prices. And if there is aggressive implementation of or deployment of renewable energy technologies, energy efficiency, that will have a significant impact on reducing those costs over time. It is also, over time, hard to estimate what some of the side impacts might be. I always like to say for under the acid rain program, one of the side effects that people didn't necessarily expect was a huge boom for Western low sulfur coal. And although nobody's expecting that under this regime, there will be other side effects like a boom for wind, biomass, renewable fuels, new domestic manufacturing opportunities. Universities, there's going to be a tremendous amount invested in new research and development. If you look at the President's economic stimulus package, it may be viewed as a down payment on that. I mean, that's over almost $100 billion invested in a lot of these technologies. I'm not going to argue that's not key to the success of any cap and trade bill down the line. Some of the things that Chris touched upon, I think, you know, some of the other things to look at in a cap and trade bill to contain costs are looking at how you handle offsets, domestic and international offsets. The more generous you are and how those are incorporated in the bill, the lower the cost of the bill is estimated to be over time. how you deal with allowances, you know, how, you know, and where you put them, who you give them to, you know, what they cost. You know, that's another factor in what the bill is going to cost over time. And, you know, at least from my perspective, although I don't live in Washington, D.C. anymore, it seems like there is a lot more serious discussion and thought by a lot of really smart people, more so than there ever has been in the past, as to how to craft a good cap and trade. And I know Chris mentioned that that certainly it is definitely a tough nut to crack, because once you do get down into the details, it is, you know, these are very complicated issues to work out. And but at the same time, people for the first time, not necessarily for the first time, at least for the first time, it seems like in the Hill, are really seriously thinking about how do we do this, and how do we do this right, and how do we do this well. And I think that's, again, one of the reasons why what the Public Utilities Commission today is doing is so important, because that's the kind of information that needs to inform what the policymakers are doing back on Capitol Hill. So I very much look forward myself to hearing what folks say later in the presentation. I'm probably running out of time, but I think it's really, I mean, maybe the takeaway from this is that it's really time for folks to take a seat at the table and make sure that their interests are protected and that their voices are heard in this debate, because they certainly don't want to be left behind. So, thank you again.
With that, we will go ahead and take a few questions. I'll go ahead and kick it off, and then we'll just sort of rotate with the commissioners here. You know, Chris, Karen, can you give us some idea of who are the power brokers? I mean, aside from obviously the all-powerful committee chairman, I mean, are there particular power brokers in the Senate that are going to be very influential as to how this policy gets crafted?
Thanks, Commissioner. Yes, just last week, and I'm delighted to see the two staffers from the two senators, because they're part of that group, at least Mr. Johnson is. 8 Democratic senators who tend to be of the moderate wing of the party came out with serious reservations and concerns with regard to specifically the budget assumption of the money and cap and trade in a more general sense. Those are 8 Democrat votes that you can't lose. So the moderate D's, if you will, the senators that represent states that currently have low-cost power that tends to be generated by coal are going to be key players, because if they go under normal order or regular order, you're going to need that 60-vote threshold. If they go by way of the budget reconciliation process, there are problems with that, because you will not, in order to waive the Byrd rule, it's a 60-vote necessity. And what you will have is numerous objections being brought up, and then the motion will be to waive the Byrd rule, and those motions will fail. And what you'll have, instead of a piece of paper, you'll have a piece of paper that looks more like a piece of Swiss cheese with holes in it, because certain provisions will not be within order in the reconciliation process. That creates another problem, which is the problem where all of a sudden you have now confusion and a lack of direction. And I'm not sure if I'm explaining this right, but without a clear guideline from Congress, and those gaps would in fact be making it unclear, I don't know how industry, I don't know how ratepayers can make determinations as to what is the regime going to look like going forward. So I think there's definite danger in taking it through the reconciliation process as opposed to going regular order. But there's a long answer to the simple thing. It's going to be the moderate Republicans and moderate Democrats that are going to swing this. And by moderate Republicans, I'm talking about Snow and Collins from Maine, and Specter from Pennsylvania on the Republican side. So, you know, the Senate being the Senate, it's there to protect, you know, the House is the emotional majority rule. The Senate is protection of minority rights. It's going to be tough to get the votes. So those 8 to 10, 12 players are going to be key.
I guess follow on what Chris said. I mean, I think if you look at the Midwest and the Great Plains states, you know, they'll have a tremendous role to play in this debate going forward, because a good number of the senators that Chris has mentioned are from that area, you know, heavily manufacturing, agricultural interests, coal. You know, these are all senators with a significant stake in what happens in any future legislation, and their concerns are going to have to be heard going forward in order, as you know, Chris says, to get that magical number of 60. And really, when you talk about major environmental legislation, if you look, you know, what's happened with past environmental legislation, it either passes big or it doesn't pass. I mean, the groundwork needs to be laid to make sure that these members feel included in the process, that their concerns are addressed, you know, I think it's going to be, it will be difficult going forward. I mean, I think like Chris said, it's you know, ultimately it's coming. It's just a matter of how, it's just a matter of when, and hopefully it's a matter of well done.
And if I could just add one thing, I was talking with a guy by the name of Joe Goffman earlier this week. Now, he was one of the prime authors of Lieberman-Warner. He has since left Mr. Lieberman, and he's now with the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee and works for Chairwoman Boxer. Mm-hmm. And he's going to be probably the point guy on the staff side. And the question was asked, well, Joe, you know, how are you envisioning what this bill is going to look like? And he said, point blank, he said, it's going to look like whatever the 60th vote wants it to look like.
Thank you for that one. I just have a kind of compounding on Dusty's question. The Dingell and the Waxman fallout, do you expect anything to cause delays from that? Do you expect any maybe competing bills from Dingell to say one person says 10%, the next one says 20%? Do you anticipate any friction on that end?
I do not. One of the reasons being, and this is really inside baseball, down the weeds kind of stuff, but I think from a tactical strategy, House leadership, Mrs. Pelosi, basically put Mr. Dingell in charge of health care reform. So he's, quote, committee chair emeritus, and even though he's not chair, he still has a staff, and she says, I want you to work on health care. So she kind of has him off working on something else. Now, does that mean he won't be a factor? Of course he will. He can still, I think, control at least a dozen votes on the committee. I don't foresee that as happening. I think what's going to happen is Mr. Markey will drop a bill, or we'll see the draft, you know, sometime next week. Markey will be the lead because he's got the subcommittee. He'll run it through his subcommittee. It'll get to full committee. It will be a little bit of a heavy lift. I anticipate that what Markey will actually introduce, or what Markey Waxman will actually introduce, believe it or not, will probably be something very, very similar to, at the end of last Congress, Mr. Boucher, who was chair of the Energy and Air Quality Subcommittee that now is chaired by Markey, and it changed its energy and environment. But anyway, Boucher and Dingell released some white papers and a draft outline of a bill that had a number of provisions in it with regard to climate. I think Markey's is going to look remarkably like that. So I don't see friction at all. Now, when it comes down to squeezing votes, and we'll see what Mr. Dingell wants to do.
Thank you.
Thank you both for coming today. Appreciate very much you traveling here to give us some insights. I have a few questions, and I'll let both of you take a shot at them if you'd like. First one is in regards to the discussion pertaining to the Clean Air Act of 1990, the purpose of which I think a number of us in the room remember, the concerns regarding acid rain, and now we don't hear a lot of discussion about acid rain. It seems to have been extremely successful, as Ms. Bridges was pointing out. My concern is that we don't use that as a foundation for assuming that all legislation of that matter might be particularly successful, not just the legislation, but the result of the legislation. Are there not significant differences? And I'd like to point to a couple of them. One, of course, is the fact that for the first time, unlike the previous, even the bills that were floated over the past couple of years, the legislation over the past couple of years, is that the administration anticipates the $645.7 billion of revenue, actually making money off of this. Does that not make it particularly onerous or at least distasteful? And does it not make it onerous on the fact that the amount of funds would, to a great extent, come from the Midwest, where the coal manufacturing, coal electricity capacity is? The coastal states would be far less affected because they have less CO2 that's generated, and therefore would it not fall upon the shoulders of those least able to pay, assuming that those folks in the Midwest are not as wealthy as the folks on the coast? So I've expressed a little bias there, but I hope you'll...
Well, I don't really want to... because I think you're addressing specifically the president's proposal in his budget about 100% auction of allowances. And, no matter what I think personally about that, I don't think that politically... getting back to that 60-vote threshold in the Senate, I don't think politically that's... Maybe I shouldn't be saying this, but necessarily a viable option. But to kind of go back to where the general burdens and benefits of this program are going to fall, I think it goes back to it's all in how you design it. Because again, when you look at the models, it really depends on the assumptions you make in terms of how you're designing the program that impacts projections of what the bill is going to cost over time. And if we do a good job in designing the bill in terms of how we address things like offsets, how we address suggestions like Chris's group has made about if you're going to have free allowances, who you give them to do the best job in minimizing impacts on low-income or ratepayers in general, and particularly those most vulnerable like low-income consumers, senior citizens. Obviously that is something that needs to be very much taken into account when you craft a bill. There are models that predict that if we do a good job about being aggressive about just energy efficiency, building efficiency, residential efficiency, weatherization, which as I think most people know, simple weatherization can dramatically reduce the impact of home heating bills. That over time, under a cap and trade bill, you actually will see lower residential rates than you would under business as usual, because consumers are responding to higher prices. There are major investments in energy efficiency, such that electricity demand is actually down a considerable amount over time. Now, again, that is assuming that we do the right thing when it comes to investments in energy efficiency. That's not to say that's also not something that very much is within the reach of a country like the United States. So I don't know if I've entirely answered your question, but again, it's I don't think anybody wants to get up here and argue that we need to to design a patently unfair bill that places all the burdens on one section of the country and shifts the benefits to another. I don't think that's what the president wants. I don't think that's what anybody in Congress is looking to do. I think, again, it circles back to what you said at the very beginning about doing this right, doing it smart, particularly in the early years of the program where there's going to be a lot of uncertainty about what the allowance prices are going to be, what the impacts are, because we can model all we want, but there's a lot of things you just can't model. And yes, in the early years, there'll be a lot of uncertainty, and that's probably where a lot of the focus in terms of how Congress designs a bill in terms of minimizing its impacts on ratepayers and businesses and consumers should perhaps have the most attention.
If I can just jump in, because it's amazing you asked that question. I couldn't have planted a better question at a hearing in the Senate myself, because as Karen was talking, I was jotting down some points that are right to your question, I think. Let me first say that this certainly is my own opinion, because I'm really straying off the reservation here from where my folks are. But first of all, let me let you know, and the commissioners certainly know this, having done this as long as I'm an ultimate skeptic and a complete and utter cynic when it comes to anything that Congress is working on. And I can say that I spent 5 years in the U.S. Senate. So there were two things or three things I want to everybody to keep in the back of their mind. The game on climate change or climate legislation changed substantially once Congress, last Congress, started focusing on Lieberman-Warner and the costs that were involved. Fundamentally changed the way the game was moving. Okay? Part of the issue is the difference between the Clean Air Act and the acid rain regime is the fact that there was technology in place then to deal with the problem they were trying to deal with. It didn't have to be invented. Didn't have to be studied in large demonstration projects. It existed. It was basically a fundamental economic choice. Do I scrub or do I not? That's what it was. Second, on the Lieberman-Warner, the basic cost, the basic cost estimates that were done by both EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, and EIA, Energy Information Administration. Two basic presumptions, or I should say assumptions. One was a huge amount of increased nuclear capacity, something to the order of 60 new units by 2030, okay, or 2035, give or take. We all knew that's ridiculous. The other thing was a basic assumption that carbon capture and sequestration would be part of the gene pool, if you will. I think for many reasons, those assumptions were wrong, and therefore the cost estimate that was in the base cost estimate in Lieberman-Warner were very off. And we can go into why that is, but I think that's.
If I could just respond,
sure.
Just really quickly, one thing Chris said about. I don't want to, pin too much on the acid rain program, because obviously this we are talking about something that's considerably broader and bigger than that was ever intended to be. And yes, there was existing technology, and it was in theory, a decision to scrub or not to scrub, but it wasn't until the law was in place that the decision to scrub was made. With dramatic benefits. And secondly, it's not that there are existing technologies today to address carbon emissions, even absent some of the more advanced technologies that we're looking at, plug-in hybrid electric vehicles, carbon capture and storage, post-combustion technologies to capture carbon. you know, I hate to keep going to efficiency, and you know, this is the kind of, you know, similar to the acid rain program, which dramatically increased the amount of scrubbing that was done, and also the amount of low sulfur coal that was used. You know, in theory, this should spur the dramatic, you know, development of renewable energy, existing renewable energy technologies.
And I think we all hope that it does.
Yes, exactly. And then also, you know, the tremendous gains that can come, particularly from commercial building efficiency, can have a, you know, there's a lot that can be done in terms of meeting near-term targets of carbon reductions or greenhouse gas reductions without these more advanced technologies, which I will agree with Chris. You know, those will be key. You know, those are key for later years, which why it goes back to the investments in research and development. To make sure that,
and I'm in agreement with you. I'm just saying these are the kinds of issues that I think are going to, mm-hmm. the political side is going to have to come,
absolutely.
You know, come to grips with,
mm-hmm.
and you know, they'll perk out, and hopefully we can all figure out how it's. I guess what I'm saying is I don't think in the out years it's a big deal.
Right.
What I'm saying is in the in years, these are issues that are going to be mm-hmm. very expensive. And, you know, I'm looking at rate payer shock at in the in years anywhere from 25% to 40% on electric bills.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a huge amount of renewables, and the renewables that we're thinking of now are wind and solar primarily, and I'm not suggesting for one second that they would be the only ones. I'm hoping we can get through something with tidal and geothermal and all of the rest. But
that's based on certain assumptions that can be addressed.
Yes. And if you're going to do it with wind and solar, you have to deal with the transmission issue, which we're going to be getting to in the energy bill.
Right.
But you also have to deal with the backup issue, and that's going to be natural gas,
mm-hmm.
which will then raise the cost of natural gas to consumers as well as industries. There's going to be the in-years are going to be tough, is what I'm saying. If we can get through the in-years, I think technology in our brains, and, you know, certainly not my brain, it's worthless. I'm not the brightest bulb in the box, but folks like Karen, et cetera, will figure this out in the out-years.
Well, let's probe at this a little bit further, and I know the goals are very aggressive in the out-years. I mean, 50% reduction and 80% reduction, not quite so aggressive in the in-years, but isn't it hard to imagine meeting those goals, those intermediate and long-term goals, without some significant breakthroughs in technological development? And how nervous should we be that it's really difficult, if not impossible, to predict when breakthroughs will come? And you just look at healthcare, all of the, you know, billions and in some cases trillions of dollars invested in trying to find a cure for this or a cure for that, and sometimes we succeed, sometimes we don't. Can either of you say anything that should make me feel more comfortable about being able to meet those robust goals and relying really on technological breakthroughs to get there?
Again, being a cynic, I'm looking at those, and this is gonna create quite a tizzy, I'm sure. But I'm looking at those out year goals as having to be readjusted, quite frankly, because I just don't think we're gonna meet them. That's just my thoughts on it. It's not based on anything any of my colleagues have said or Congress has said, but I hope I'm wrong. I hope I'm dead wrong, and I would be delighted to come back here and say, Karen, I'm dead wrong. I apologize, but I think what you're going to see, and that's going to create more indecision, which is going to create more uncertainty. But I think as we get into it, depending on what the in-years are going to be and what the out-years are going to be. You know, you're looking at 2050, 2060, 2080. Depending on what that scale is, they may have to come back and say, geez, you know, just like with Kyoto, we can't meet this.
Well,
it's not working.
And a quick follow-up that you can both address. I mean, Chris, if that's true, I mean, right now we've got some people saying that if you don't get to 80% reduction, that there will be tragic and long-term, I mean, catastrophic effects. If you believe, and Karen, obviously want to hear from you too, if we can't get there, then where does that leave us as far as an investment and struggling to meet the near-term goals that you alluded to, Chris, that relatively expensive costs on the front end?
Well, not being a scientist, and therefore I can't comment on what the consequences of not meeting the goals are. But I think part of the issue is going to be, can the ratepayer, or will the ratepayer, I should say, just decide to suck it up, if you will, take the hit, pay the money, keep going, and if they don't scream and holler, then we just keep moving on and everything goes as planned. Listen, you know, you got the two Senate staffs in here. The best thing anybody can do to try to affect how legislation looks is to make sure you contact your senators. And it's not like I'm ignoring the House, but the fight's going to be in the Senate. Mm-hmm. The fight's going to be in the Senate. The Senate will make or break any of this. So you pick up the phone and you call those guys every day of the week. And you say, you know, either this stinks and this is good, or that's what I'm going to say on that.
Yeah, I guess I have a little bit more faith in the American ingenuity and the pace of technological innovation. It's not just going to be in America. You know, globally, there's going to be a tremendous amount of focus on this and investment worldwide. And you know, you're right. I mean, nobody can sit here and predict what technology is going to look like 50 years from now. But you know, we didn't really have much in the way of computers or the internet, you know, that sort of thing 50 years ago either. And we're living in a completely different world, and I don't think it's unrealistic to assume that we're going to be living in a completely different world 50 years from now in terms of where our technology is. Again, it's like that chicken and the egg argument. You know, you need the price to drive the change, but you also don't want price to provoke the kind of, you know, backlash and burdens that Chris is talking about. And again, I hate to circle back to, you know, the way you design the program. I know Chris doesn't trust Congress, but
I didn't say I didn't trust them. I said I'm skeptical of them.
I work there, so I wouldn't trust them. But it's a bill like this is not going to pass unless those near term concerns are addressed. And you know, there's banking allowances, you know, allowing entities to borrow from future allowances, the use of offsets, a board that is empowered to change how allowances are distributed and their cost, to respond to concerns about, you know, volatility and spikes in allowance prices, to make sure that you are cushioning those impacts, in addition to, you know, aggressive attempts to get money to those that need it the most.
And Karen makes a good point, because a lot of this depends on what you're going to do with this windfall mm-hmm. of cap and trade dollars that the government is going to take. Should they? And again, this is part of the calculation. What makes it so difficult? Should that money go all to the ratepayers to cushion? Should that money be split up to pay for low income? Should that money go as part of the budget says for health care, or should that money go for these technologies that could help move forward and lessen the cushion and lessen the burden in the out years? So these are all those decisions. You know, in Washington, we kid around a lot about, you know, we just passed an $800 billion stimulus package and a $412 billion appropriation for FY09. I mean, it used to be the old saying was, a billion here, a billion there, you're talking about real money. Now we're in the trillions. We don't need to think about it until it has a T. So you're talking about a lot of money, and a lot of the, you know, how this money is going to be apportioned out. And I don't want to say appropriated, because if there's one group I do not trust, it's the appropriator. Sorry, guys. But
thank you. I just have maybe a two-part question here. First of all, I see a lot of trouble with the cap-and-trade system. I kind of see, I don't believe that it's going to happen. I do believe that the bill's going to split, and we're going to end up with a national RPS out of the whole deal.
They're looking at that being as, you know, a dual, not a one or the other.
Well, that's part of my question. Do you think that there will be, that cap-and-trade will go to the wayside, or do you think there'll be competing bills? And to my first point, that I believe that an RPS will prevail, what do you think that number will be?
Two things. Let me try to address them in back and forth. They're looking at RPS and cap and trade as being complementary, not adversary. So having one and not the other, I mean, getting one means the other one doesn't have, no. They're looking at the RPS as a way to improve the technology and the renewables to get to where Karen is saying, to the point that it lessens the blow, if you will, on ratepayers in general. As far as the number goes, the last draft I saw on Bingaman was, 20%, Karen, I think, his latest draft. I think it was 20% by 2025, I want to say, or 2030. I don't know. Anyway, I don't think you'll be 20%. I think it'll be closer to 15 if they move it. Now, there's obviously difficulties in getting the RES, as they call it, now. It's no longer an RPS. And one of the big issues the RPS, RES, is the arguments go this way. One argument says, are you trying, with an RPS, are you trying to deal with no or low carbon emissions, or are you trying to subsidize renewables? At first you think, well, isn't that the same? No, it's not the same. If the goal is to reduce carbon, goes one argument, then why not have nuclear and efficiency being able to make up the 20%? Okay, the other argument says, well, no, we want to do both things. We want to reduce carbon, but we also want, in order to make a cap and trade work, specifically in the out years, we want to make sure that these renewable resources are economically in play. Okay, so I don't know if I answered your question directly, but that's kind of the dynamic that's going on. How is that going to happen? I don't think that the folks that want to do efficiency and nuke are going to win the day. I think maybe the efficiency number will be something like you can reach up to 5 or 6% through efficiency, but the rest has to be through renewable resources. So.
Yeah, I don't have a lot to add to that. I mean, I know that an RPS or RES or, you know, whatever they're calling it now is very important to the chairman of the Senate Energy Committee, Senator Bingaman.
That's his baby.
But I know that ultimately a decision hasn't been yet made by the leadership as to what they're going to do with the two bills. And it's.
One of the difficulties on the RES, quite frankly, is what we call universal currency, and that means those states that have already moved to an RES, well, or an RPS, well, they're already issuing allowances and credits and all of that, and under a federal program, one would presume that those would no longer work, meaning you would have a credit would be good in Maine, would be good in Florida, would be good in California, as opposed to the way it is now in the 25 states that have moved forward. Another obvious question is going to be, well, what is a renewable? Some are trying to say nuclear is renewable. I think they're incorrect. Obviously, it's not renewable. It's low carbon, which goes back to my initial point. So you have RPS, when you think about it, sounds like a great idea, but when you start peeling the onion, there are a lot of tricky issues that they're going to have to get through with that. And please don't take any of my comments as saying I'm poo-pooing carbon cap and trade, I'm poo-pooing climate change, poo-pooing RPS. Not at all. I'm agnostic to all of them. My association has very, very strict guidelines down the middle on a lot of this. So.
Thank you. I have a question for each of you, and since my question for Karen is going to be more challenging.
Good. Check in the mail.
I'll ask that one first and let you chew on it a little bit and let Chris answer the other
question. The easy one?
The easy one first.
Thank you.
Europe has the
largest cap and trade system in the world. Unfortunately, from their phase one from 2005 to 2007 resulted in an actual increase of 2% as opposed to a decrease. The electric bills also in Europe have gone up significantly as a result of that. According to a recently released data from the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, the U.S. greenhouse gas emissions increased almost 15% during that period of time, 90 to 2006. And in Austria, in the Kyoto Treaty countries, Austria's went up 15.2%, Germany's went up 18.5%, Greece was up 24.4%, Ireland was up 25.5%, Italy's up 10%, Japan up 6%, and New Zealand's was up 28%. Portugal's was up 38%, Spain was up 50%. In light of that, if those facts are accurate, which I assume they are, what effects do you think that those actual facts will have on the environmental lobbies and on Congress and any other comments you'd like to make pertaining to those? And Chris, I have a tendency to agree with you that this is going to be real challenging for Congress to pass, because on March 15, 16 Democrat senators called for changes to the cap and trade proposal outlined by the Obama administration to make it less painful for utilities relying on coal-based generation for consumers, and they're concerned that a lot of industry will move from the Midwest and be challenged, and electric utility costs would increase substantially in the Midwest. However, the EPA, just a week later, sent a proposal to the White House Office of Management and Budget stating that CO2 is a danger to public health, and proposed rulemaking that would treat CO2 as a pollutant. So I'm curious what your thoughts are as to the effect that EPA's statement coming out and treating CO2 as a pollutant would be. The effect on legislation. Oh, that's not an easy question. Sorry about that.
I'm canceling that check. Karen, did you want to go first, or are you still pondering?
Yeah, it's up to you. It's
My answer is pretty quick.
Okay, go.
It's certainly meant, the EPA activity certainly meant to keep heat on Congress to keep moving, because Congress doesn't want to allow their authority to go to an agency. So I think it's more the stick and then the carrot approach on that particular one. That's the stick, meaning Congress, if you don't do it, we'll do it for you. I mean, it's a long process, and you know, it's not like it's going to happen tomorrow. What they're doing is they're putting Congress on notice. The administration is putting Congress on notice that if you don't do it, we will.
Okay. I just added that I'm sure there's a hope that by EPA moving forward, that then Congress will start hearing about from the regulated community that, you know, wait a minute, we want the consistency and uniformity that comes from a federal program. We don't want ad hoc regulation and ad hoc actions by various states on this. But I am not an expert on the European system. But I do know that, they were kind of the first big experimenters with, you know, how to put together this kind of program and how to make it work. And I think even the Europeans would admit that they made a lot of mistakes in putting that that program together. I think they gave away a tremendous amount of allowances for free, which, you know, on the one hand, in theory, cushions the cost of the program, but on the other hand, you know, you need to find a balance there, because you're also not deriving the investments that need to be made in technologies that are going to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, which is one of the reasons you may have seen, they didn't have to, because they had free allowances, it was still cheaper for them to, continue with business as usual rather than changing, becoming more efficient, investing in different technologies, that sort of thing. But, you know, you can really look at it as, well, it's a lesson for the United States. I mean, it's something that, and I'm sure that folks in Congress are doing that, is sitting down and dissecting what went on in Europe and what were the mistakes that they made and you know, what can we learn from that in terms of designing a program in the United States. He's a cynic, I'm the optimist. you should look at something like that as an opportunity to do a better job, and I think the Europeans themselves are doing that as well. I mean, I think it just it goes back to what a lot of people said about just the enormous challenge. I mean, it's challenges on both ends. It's a challenge to address the problem, and then it's also an enormous challenge if we don't do anything, we don't address the problem, the possibilities that could come down the road and, you know, impact all of us if we don't act. So
we will be taking a short break, and certainly I know there are questions. We wanted to get some audience questions, but we're running right on schedule right now. If you've got questions, please feel free to grab Chris and Karen. After the break, we'll have a short 15-minute break. After, as interesting as this has been, I think for me it's going to be really interesting to see from the South Dakota perspective what are the estimated costs on South Dakota families, businesses, ratepayers in general. That's what we've got coming up from a panel of experts after the break. But this has really been very helpful. Ms. Bridges, Mr. Melee, let's give them a round of applause. And we'll be back at 10:35. Thanks.
Okay. I think that's going to be the
And that works?
Oh, yep.
Great.
All right, ladies and gentlemen.
When you're done, Steve, can you right-click to end your show?
Sure.
And then that way the others are down here, then Steve can grab his pretty quickly.
Okay. Okay.
Very good. That's yours. Who's got the other board?
That one is Barbara Long, and I've got
oh,
that on a slide, so we don't need to use it.
Oh, okay. I thought you had
maybe.
The Barbara one. Okay.
So I think we'll be okay without it. All right.
You guys have some tough questions I can ask you.
All of them are tough questions for me.
All right, next up we're going to hear three different perspectives from five different very good presenters. First up is Steve Willard, who has spent, I guess, a little more than a year now as the head of the investor-owned utility group in South Dakota. And he's been great to work with, and we're looking forward to the information he's going to provide. Steve, take it away.
All right, thank you. My name is Steve Willard. Got the mic. There he goes. I'm the executive director of the South Dakota Utility, Electric Utility Companies, the shareholder-owned utilities. In order of their electric customers in South Dakota, that would be Xcel Energy, Black Hills Corp, Northwestern Energy, Ottertail Power, Montana Dakota Utilities, and Mid-American Energy. Collectively, they serve more than 229,000 customers, which is about 55% of the retail electric customers in South Dakota, just to put in context for you. We appreciate the opportunity very much. Thank the commissioners and particularly the staff because they had to put this thing together with short notice, and they never ever get the recognition, and we know they do the work. We have a very productive relationship with the commission, with the staff. We don't always agree, but there's candor and constructive disagreements. That's kind of a healthy tension that serves South Dakota citizens really well, because in the end, all of us serve the same audience. Whether they're customers or citizens or voters, we're all responsible to the same people. So we're here this morning to respond to a request by the Commission for analysis of Lieberman Warner on South Dakota electric rates. You can see the date on this presentation is March 26th, because that's the date which we were asked to provide the information to. So that's the date that we put out. Today is actually the 27th, but that's the day that we submitted the information to the commission as per their request. And each of the companies has submitted their own analysis. Now, not all of that information is going to be available to you at this time, because literally we put it together in about 2 weeks by yesterday. But I know that the commission is intending to take a look at that and take you through those numbers and do something with that going forward. So my job this morning is to kind of give you an overview of the company information, and then I'll give you a little bit of different perspective. In advance, I would say that Brian asked me if I could spice it up a little bit, and I'll try to do that. So first, I'm not an engineer. I'm not a scientist. I'm not an attorney, and I'm not a climatologist either. My background is political science. I'm a lobbyist. And we just came out of our legislative session, so if I sound a little combative, some of that's just residual. And while that seems far afield, it's really not, because global warming is essentially a political movement. And in political fights of this nature, oftentimes the debate comes down to science versus authority. And because the public doesn't usually want to deal with the science, they'll defer to the authority, whether that's Congress or, in this particular case, the commission. So speaking politically, I'm not certain that this fight hasn't already been won or lost, because we're on the brink of taking political action on global warming, whether we do it with climate legislation in Congress, whether we do it through the regulatory process and endangerment with EPA, or whether we do it internationally in Copenhagen this coming December. And probably for the companies, that may be the biggest difference between the positions. Because we've got individuals who want to fight because they just flat believe this thing is wrong. And we've got individuals that have reconciled themselves to the idea that it's inevitable. And so we're trying to manage the outcome. And all the commissioners are political, and all the commissioners are voters. And I guess I would ask them, you know, when do you decide to stop fighting and try to make sure you can live with the final product? And that's the dilemma that we face today. What I do know is that everyone that sits in this room is going to be the ones that are charged with implementing many of the mandates that come from this thing.
And believe me, when rates increase, and they will, that no one will remember that Congress is responsible. They'll blame everybody that's sitting in here, because Washington's a long ways away from South Dakota. So in the end, we work with the process, and we trust the process, because we have to. But also, we have to count on our citizens to have enough interest to that they'll provide some direction and some feedback. And I think that's occurring, because once customers start to get a sense of the cost of this legislation, they're going to decide whether or not to support it, because then it'll have an impact. So our job is to facilitate the learning, and that's why we're here this morning. So for citizens that are trying to work through this issue, there's a lot of information out there, and it's hard to come to a reasonable conclusion, and there's a lot of noise from both sides. And this isn't an ordinary public policy dispute, because the stakes are high. This is literally about the end of the earth as we know it, as it's being characterized. And, you know, for me, I'm not dismayed about, you know, dueling interest groups and all that noise, because it's part of the fabric of the system, and I like a good political fight. So without much further explanation, I'll take you through a little bit of the information that we put together and talk about the impact on South Dakotans and talk about how I try to come to grips with this issue myself. So for those of you that are trying to come information on both sides, one of my favorite sites is essentially non-political, but write this one down, climatedebatedaily.com. It's put together by the guys that do Arts and Letters Daily. You can see, I didn't bring the cover page up, but on the left side, research supporting the idea that it's a clear threat, that it's caused by humans, and that solutions are within human reach. And the right side of it essentially challenges that view. And literally, it remains neutral. And it's the best side I've seen, both scientific articles and the like. And it'll take on both sides of the discussion. And it's a great site. I guarantee that you'll love it and you'll learn a lot. So here's another one that really doesn't mean anything other than it's kind of comforting, because I can look at South Dakota. Purdue University this last summer has started to try to grid, has claimed to have the best information out there about CO2 emissions. And you can look at the map and you can see how much we're all contributing to this equation. Those green lines across South Dakota are the interstates, by the way. But that's just a comfortable one for me, because that's technology to map CO2 emissions. But we're here this morning to talk about Lieberman Warner. So going forward, you know, I don't know what to call it. That's a little clunky, so I'll just call it climate bill. That's short and it's easy. Because you have to remember that Lieberman Warner was introduced in 2007, and it doesn't exist anymore. The framework remains, the elements remain, the discussion remains, so there'll be pieces of it. And the best representation I've ever seen of Lieberman Warner, and I wasn't able to reduce this to a slide, we've got on this graph, was given to me by my friend Barb Czar of Black Hills Corp, and that's essentially Lieberman Warner. The red box, the red circles are the mandates. The blue circles are the regulations. The black is the Boxer amendments to Lieberman-Warner, which essentially composed of about 1,000 pages, came in the last hours of the bill at the time it was introduced. So each of the blue circles goes through the orange process in the middle. That's the best graphic representation I've ever seen, and you can't reduce it, because within each one of those circles is either a description of a regulation or a mandate. So don't underestimate what a challenge this thing is. And that's the best I've ever seen. So for our purposes, I want to take you to a slide specific to Lieberman Warner, because it's, you know, we made some references to it earlier, and I'll go past that one. Well, this is why it's topical. This is transportation CO2. This is part of the endangerment discussion. You can see over in the far left, about 40% of the emissions are combustion electricity. That's why they care about us. Because if you're trying to regulate CO2, then if you get 40% of the emissions, then you want to take it on. That's why it's topical to electricity. The red bar is the transportation side of that equation, and that's about 33% of it. So if you get your arms around those two, then you've taken almost 75% of the CO2 emissions. So if you wonder why they're singling us out, that's why. And if you're wondering why we're talking about transportation, that's why. So this particular site, and it's an EIA site, and I'm going to blow through some slides and I'll explain why, and I think you'll understand it, is that at the time they did Lieberman Warner, there was an exhaustive set of analysis done. Most of the information was put out in the spring of 2008, and these are the analysis that came along with it. And all this stuff is on the EIA and the DOE site, but all of it's available. The best case, you can see all those different analyses, and they took it on in a lot of different ways and a lot of different professionals and a lot of different angles. So I'm gonna just roll through these slides, and let me tell you to look for a couple of things. My point is this, that when you try to pick a particular model, it all depends on the model that you choose. There's a lot of different variables at play. We talked about a couple of them earlier. One of them is the number of nuclear plants. One of them is how fast we can capture carbon. One of them is where the carbon tax falls. So I'm going to knock through a lot of different analysis, a lot of different slides, and your whole purpose here is to look at the differences. So here's those primary differences. Nuclear generation, carbon capture and storage, how soon the new renewables come along, what do you do with the offsets, and where the natural gas prices fall. Those are the elements at play. Now watch these slides. First one, 40 nukes, carbon price 48 in the short years, 76 in the long. 55% nukes, 18, 38. 117 nukes, 18, 50. 3.5 nukes, 48, 86. 10 to 25, that doesn't make a difference. 55 to 64 a ton, $227 a ton in the out years. 44 nukes, 62 by 2030. I don't know if you started today, you could get to 62. $40 a ton in 2015, $83 a ton in 2030. And the point being that EIA ran a lot of different angles at this thing. They had an awful lot of professionals. They had an awful lot of expertise to look at this issue. And they came down about six different ways. There's no single answer to this solution. So it depends on where you land with each one of the variables. So when they came back to us and asked to estimate the costs, that was kind of a challenge for us. And we did it knowingly and willingly. So let me give you a sense of what the impact on South Dakota customers were. And I make that point because probably the biggest challenge we had as a group is which variables do we choose? Do you figure there's an auction? Do you figure there's an offset? Do you figure there's nukes? Do you figure we've got carbon capture? But I showed the slides to tell you that we're not alone because the feds had the same problem when they evaluated the issue. So for us, when they came down, the bottom line, Lieberman-Warner analysis, the overview, is that they figured a low of $18 a ton carbon tax to a high of 76 in the short years and 38 to 271 in the out years. So the mean is $42. So that's, we use that number in a lot of different scenarios. That's about where we landed. Now remember, that's the mean. So you're going to give or take in there somewhere. And we use those numbers based on the information that came out of the Fed's analysis. What we did is apply that to our rates. So let me show you a couple of those windows and give you a sense of what those costs are. I got these from, we all were essentially asked to put this together in the last week and a half, so I don't have each of the companies in here, but I'll explain that to you a little bit. And then for questions that you want to ask about a particular company in their scenario, we've got representatives here, so I think they can probably answer those, and I can tell you in most cases. This is from Black Hills Power and Light and Cheyenne Light. You can see at $40, which is the mean, that their expectation based on customers today, based on auction, is a 68% cost on average. That's by 2015. So it's 68%. And that's the mean, folks. So give or take a little bit, and it depends on the scenarios and depends on how you treat them. So it's a moving target. Is it impossible? There's no single answer to this, but we wanted to make sure that you sense. What we did is we applied these to existing customers to get a sense of what the impact would be. So for Black Hills, at the mean, 68% increase. Northwestern Energy, now this one, the best slide that Northwestern put together, and there's a lot of great, now I should qualify it too, each of these slides have been provided to you along with individual bills and representations in the background. I wanted to give you a little summary this morning to kind of put your arms around it. Northwestern used, you can see it up on top, $20 a ton with 100% auction. They did that because that was the recommendation by the Obama administration. So for a $20 per ton carbon tax, now that's half the mean, that's on the low end of the scale, you can see for residentials, 22%. Commercials, you're in that 22 to 19%. Commercial, retail, industrial, you're on 40%. Now, that's the low end of the scale. If, in fact, you get closer to the mean, you can double those numbers. So now that also assumes 100% auction. So if those offsets come back to us, then we get an opportunity to pass along some of the savings. And remember that those increases that your commercial and industrial providers are going to incur, they're going to have to pass along in some fashion. Otter Tail said, okay, we'll do the same thing, 20, 30, 40, 50, and I broke it down in this fashion. Look at the $40 ton because that's the mean. For Otter Tail customers, which essentially serves the northeastern part of the state, you can see for residential they figured 55% increase, commercial 54%. Industrial 75% with an increase of 64% on average for South Dakota customers. This would be in the short years, in the 2015. The number on the bottom struck me. I don't know if you can read that, so I'll read it to you. Assuming no growth in sales and a level CO2 charge, now that's at $40 a ton, South Dakota customers would pay out over $189 million from 2010 to 2040 is what they figure the expense and what the cost would be to live with this thing at $40, assuming no changes. So, of course, there'll be changes. So, Mid-American did the low, mean, and the high. And you can see, you can look in the mean. Now, they figured same thing. They did exactly use the low, mean, and the high. But you look at the mean, the $42, you can see their expectation for industrial is a 71% increase. For commercial, a 43% increase. For residential, a 41% increase. Now, again, folks, that's assuming no offsets. So I want to make sure that you understand what we're talking about because we try to treat them consistently. So if there's allowances made or those monies come back to us in some fashion, then those numbers go down. But, if, you know, I hope they go down from 74% because that may be our only chance. So I'm going to talk for a second, and I'll do it quickly because, as you can see, I'm looking at my time. I don't want to bump into Steve's time because he's very eloquent. We talked a little bit about coal, and I'm going to give you the short version of why coal matters in South Dakota. Here's why it matters nationally, because about 48% of our fuel mix nationally is coal. 21% is natural gas. So you can see that those two combined are about 70% of the equation. If costs go up for each, it's going to have an impact. But 48% on the coal. So here's why it matters to South Dakota. You can see by state what percentage of coal they use. Our number is a little bit down because of WAPA and because of hydro, so our number is a little bit deceptive in there. Now, the other thing that we haven't talked too much about is coal and low cost, and you can credit these commissioners and their predecessors, and you've got SAR sitting in the audience, but on the zero for the states in South Dakota or the states across the nation from 1 to 50 high to low, South Dakota traditionally ranges in about that 40 range. So for us, we're one of the least expensive electricity states in the nation, and we're highly coal-dependent. But let me put it in context for you, regional context. These are different regions and their coal mix. What they call West-North Central, which is South Dakota, North Dakota, and the states around us, are 74% coal. So you cannot put a tax on coal without having a profound impact in South Dakota. It just cannot, will not. That's the impact. That's the deal. 74%. So, for us, the short version, and to conclude, I want to give you a couple things to consider. First one, I would ask the commissioners, and I know that their expectation is to take those recommendations and put them out to the public for you to get a chance to kind of distill them. Take a look at the individual company recommendations within the reports because there's a lot of good individual company feedback about how to reconcile ourselves with this thing. Second, and congratulations to Chris. I think he had to leave to catch a flight, but NARUC has been front and center on this thing and has done a really nice job, and credit to you and commissioners and the organization for doing that. Their recommendations really aren't bad. Also, don't underestimate the costs. Because not only is there a personal impact on this thing, and that's probably the single biggest problem I have with D.C., and I fly there myself this afternoon, is that this whole thing seems impersonal. It's all about policy, and it's all about legislation, and you know, we said that we may even be affected indirectly. Well, folks, you're talking about a 40 to 70% personal increase, and then you have to assume that the commercial and the industrial customers aren't going to be able to absorb the whole thing themselves. So my expectation is that they'll pass a little bit of that along as well. So don't underestimate the cost of this thing. If we're going to do it with transparency. Let's be honest. Let's not pass what may be a $650 billion tax increase to fund health care under the idea that we're going to make the climate greener. If, in fact, we impose the tax, then let's spend the money to accomplish what we set out to accomplish. Do it with honesty and do it with transparency and do it with some integrity. And then in the end, protect the consumer. Whether you do that with off-ramps, or whether you do that with price collars, or whether you do that with allocations, make sure that in the end the consumer is not the one that's popped, because they're going to be. There's no doubt about that they will be. And probably last, we will be part of the solution. We're not going away. We serve 55% of the customers in South Dakota. We have been taking action already on this issue. You've got MDU and Otter Tail trying to build a coal plant in the Northeast that literally lessens the reductions of the first plant, and we can't get it built. You've got Xcel has spent significant funds working on battery backup for wind. They're working smart grids in Colorado. You've got Northwestern just signed on to the Green Power Express line because they're trying to figure out a way to assimilate wind. Black Hills Corp has got an application for a demonstration project into the DOE on this subject for carbon sequestration. So the technology that we're dependent upon, we can't get a demonstration project approved. So we will be part of the solution, and we're not going to go away. So in the end, all I'll leave you with is a couple things that I add to, just because I'm a political science guy. Woodrow Wilson, who they credit to be the father of essentially a political science or public administration, said that in government, as in virtue, the hardest of hard things is to make progress. Wherever regard for public opinion is a first principle of government, reform must be slow and reform must be full of compromises. For wherever public opinion exists, it must rule. Probably the one comforting thing that I came away with, and I appreciate so much your coming this morning, but the one comforting thing that I came away with is that an awful lot of really smart people are taking a close look at this thing on the Hill for the first time, because that may be our only chance. Because sincerely, if smart people take a close look at this issue, then maybe we'll come to some solutions. But as it exists today, it's going to present some challenges for consumers in South Dakota. Because in the end, for me, democracy and the system and Congress and the like is a lot more than just choosing leaders. It's a lot more than a policy outcome. John Stuart Mill said, "The ultimate end of democracy is not the laws that it produces, but enhancement of the intelligence of its own people." So I think it's our own obligation, and I think it's an opportunity for us to learn a lot about this subject. And I think as people start to get a sense of the cost and the impact, that they'll avail themselves of that opportunity. And I think they have to, because important problems don't have easy solutions. And part of the reason of that is other major problems connect with dozens of other major problems. Yeah, we fixed acid rain, but we created a dependence on coal. So one problem begat another, apparently. So in the end, sometimes the best public policy can do is to cope and not resolve. And folks, that's all we're trying to do in this thing is we're just trying to cope. So thanks for the time.
Thanks very much, Steve. Next presenter is Steve Tomac, who's the senior legislative representative for Basin Electric, and he's got a very good resume to deal with these sort of issues. Been the head of the Farm Credit, the North Dakota Farm Credit Council, former 16-year North Dakota legislator, and chair of a rural electric cooperative, if memory serves. So, go ahead and take it away, Steve.
Thank you, Commissioner, and members here today. Actually, I'm kind of the substitute today, if you will. Mike Agle had hoped to be here today, but many of you have heard about the ice jam just south of Bismarck that backed water up into some areas that haven't been flooded since the dam was built. And Mike is one of those victims. He lives on, you may have heard, Fox Island, and that's where he lives. And the call came out. I wasn't able to respond to it last night, but he made a call about 5 o'clock yesterday afternoon asking, any of you guys want to come over and pull up carpet, you just come on over. So that's what I think Mr. Agle is doing today. And our hearts and prayers are also with the people that are battling the flood near Fargo, which is going to reach apparently a level of 43 or 44 foot, which is an all-time high in recorded history. So we're battling that in North Dakota, but I can tell you that the flight down this morning was smooth, and you don't have snow down here, so that was a breath of fresh air to get away from the snow. What I wanted to cover this morning, excellent presentation, Steve. Appreciated that, your remarks, and I'll try not to duplicate those. Basin's approach was a little bit different in that what we have done is considered eight different scenarios, eight different possibilities that we see of typical legislation that we may see. Let me back up just a step, though, and talk a little bit about what Basin does in South Dakota. Basin Electric serves 125 rural electric co-ops in 9 states. We are served, and many of our members are here today, and we appreciate that. We in South Dakota, the areas are served by Rushmore, which is a G&T located in Rapid City, and by East River, which is located in Madison. We also have 2 District 9 Class A members that buy their power directly from Basin, they are Grand and Rosebud. So South Dakota is the only state in our service territory that is 100% Basin Electric as far as power. They also, each of these co-ops also receives some supplemental power from WAPA or from the dams. What we did was actually analyzed 8 different cases, and what I've brought for you this morning was 5 of those cases in our analysis. We did an extensive analysis on Lieberman-Warner, on particularly the Boxer Amendment and the low case and the high case on that. We also, in one of the 5 cases that you'll see here directly, is a hybrid model of a carbon tax that converts to a cap and trade, which is a model that is currently under discussion within the rural electric system. And then we also have an analysis of the Bingaman bill, which was the predecessor to Lieberman-Warner. And we also have a discussion, case number 8 is a straight carbon tax bill. And so as we tried to develop our carbon mitigation plan within the Basin family, these are 5 of the 8 cases that we analyzed. And I have to tell you that it gets very complex, convoluted. It really gets difficult because there are a whole range of assumptions that you need to make to even perform the analysis. And so one has to wonder at the end of the day whether or not we've really reached a conclusion. But we need to start somewhere. And so there's a whole range of possibilities within these proposals. The price of CO2 varies, as Mr. Willard accurately pointed out. It can vary from, in our analysis, I think $6 to actually $10 to $40, $50. And it depends on whether you go with 100% auction of the credits or whether or not you're allocated some of those credits and you have ownership of those, whether or not you get free allowances or whether it's a straight tax, and whether or not there are bonuses for early adoption credits for carbon capture or whether there are no bonuses. And there are also some variability and differences in these bills as to whether as to how they treat new power plants. And so with that in mind, we made a few assumptions within the Basin family. As many of you know, we're currently received an RUS loan of somewhat in excess of $300 million to put a carbon capture to take a 120-megawatt slipstream off our Antelope Valley station and do carbon capture off of that, demonstrating a technology that we have contracted with, and putting that into a CO2 pipeline and sending that to Weyburn, Saskatchewan, where it's currently used for enhanced oil recovery. The pipeline is already in existence because our Dakota gasification plant there already captures CO2 and uses that pipeline. We actually have excess capacity in that pipeline. So we assume that the AVS demonstration project goes forward in this analysis. We also made the assumption that the next gen plant that we have planned in Selby, South Dakota, when this analysis was made, we were envisioning that to have carbon capture on the back end of that. That's assumed in this. We also assume that we'd as you did, that we will continue to purchase the same amount of power and sell the same amount of power that we have. So we've got that as a constant. And for the sake of these proposals, we also assume that the price of natural gas does not change, which, as you've pointed out, and I think one of the speakers did this morning too, is that obviously if we're forced into a wind gas strategy, the price of natural gas is going to go up. And but for the sake of this discussion, that's the assumptions we made. What you see here is a fairly complicated graph, but this is actually has all eight of the cases in there. On the bottom is the timeline, 2009 to 2021. Frankly, our analysis kind of quits at 2018 for two reasons. One is our financial forecast. We regularly do a 10-year financial forecast, and we think beyond 2018 and most certainly 2021, it's just hypothetical at best to even go much beyond that. So we don't do much analysis beyond that. On the left hand of the chart is the net impact. Now, I want to clarify this up front, especially for the commissioners, because this is just the impact to Basin Electric. Basin Electric is a generation and transmission co-op. This does not, how the individual co-ops that are our member owners treat this will be up to them. But this is the cost that we will pass on to them. And so you can see the different cases, and they all kind of head in the same direction. I would tell you that there is a difference, though, especially as you look at this, and we can bone down into this. But the top line there, the purple line, if you will, that is case number 6, which is one of the 5 cases that I will show you. And that is actually the Bingaman proposal, the Bingaman bill, and the impact that has on Basin Electric. The one that has the greatest impact to Basin Electric is the light blue line on the bottom, and that is the high-cost Boxer Amendment. And that has the most dramatic impact. Now, there's a stark difference in these two bills, because the Boxer bill, I've got a slide on that, but essentially the Bingaman bill allows for some early bonus credits, early adoption credits and some bonuses, and the Boxer bill has a floor but not a ceiling. Bingaman has a ceiling but not a floor. Bingaman also has a safety valve. Boxer does not. And so there's some differences of how they treat that. Here are the 5 cases. Case number 1, again, on the bottom, cases 1, 3, 4, 6, and 8. Case 1 is the hybrid model that we're currently just kicking around just to engage discussion to see where we need to be. That is a hybrid model that has a carbon tax to start with and converts to a cap and trade. Cases 3 and 4 are Boxer. One is a low cost and one is a high cost based on the amendment that Senator Boxer introduced last June. Case number 6 is the Bingaman bill, which was, correct me if I'm wrong, is that 05, 06, something like that, I think. And case number 8 is a straight carbon tax bill. This, again, is the impact. If on the left-hand side is the total dollar amount that it would impact Basin Electric, and the smaller, lighter blue line or bar is the DGC, our Dakota Gasification Company. The impact it will, because what the Dakota Gasification Company is uses lignite coal and converts it to gas, and so it does impact CO2. As you can see, the worst-case scenario is this is an annual cost. I'd better not say that. What's that? Pardon? It I'm not sure it's a 10-year, we've got annual costs coming up here, but as you can see, the Boxer Amendment high cost is $6.1 billion. And interestingly enough, the Bingaman bill actually has a net gain because of the early adoption credits and bonuses. The range of costs is $1.6 billion. You're right, Scott, it's a 10-year cost. $1.6 billion to $6.1 billion. And the one case number six, is the Bingaman bill would have generated a net of $631 million over that 10-year period. The wholesale cost increase, as put in terms of mills, would be this. As you can see, case one, which is the hybrid model, and the light blue in this case is the year 2018, and the dark blue is the year 2012. It varies from about 2.6 mills in the first year to 8, in the best case scenario, 2.6 mills to almost 19 mills, and in 2018, 2.5 mills to a little over 30 mills. And again, one case, as you can see, the Bingaman bill would have had, at least in 2018, would have been a net increase. That, and just to help you understand the methodology, I'm going to just take you through one of these cases to give you a better flavor of that. Case one is the hybrid. We made some assumptions here. You get 100% allocation, no bonus allocations, and no allocation for new entrants. And this is the impact that it has each year to our members. Kind of in that 7 mil range, just for the carbon impact. This on the bottom, it's 2012. That's what our financial forecast shows our base rate to our member owner co-ops will be, and the 7.68 to 7.6 is the amount of increase that we're projecting based on this case number one. That gives an average on this is our four co-ops in South Dakota. The left hand is Rosebud. The next one is Grand, the next one is East River, and the last one is Rushmore. This gives the average impact to those co-ops of 8 mills based on this. And this is the 2018 estimated impact. I think with that, I'm just going to close. I could go through each one of these cases, but you kind of get the picture. We really need to go back to... let me just back up a step here and pull up this slide. Go back up to the wholesale price increase, which is what I really wanted to focus on here. I think we've drawn a couple conclusions. One, it's impossible for us to really know what's going to happen. We do get a flavor for what we want and what we don't want as we proceed with some form of climate legislation. And one of the things that we really want within the Basin family is we want to be at the table. We understand that if we're in denial, we're not going to be at the table, and it becomes very apparent that climate change legislation is real, it's going to happen, and so we need to get at the table, and for one primary reason, and that's to bring some certainty to the process. To meet under our load forecast, if we're going to meet the needs of our member owners, in future years, we need to begin building and planning another power plant, which is the one we've got targeted for Selby at this point. If we're going to build that, and we can't borrow into an uncertain climate right now, to bring that certainty to the financial market, we need some certainty in climate change legislation. And so we need to bring some certainty to this process so that we can go on with our planning, so we can provide the reliable electricity we're used to. And so bringing certainty to the process is important to us. We also believe that we need to incentivize carbon capture. We believe that that needs to happen. And we also believe that this can't be a tax on utilities only. And I think, Steve, you mentioned that. This needs to be transportation, everybody that's involved in this. I think one of the examples I've seen out of the REGI the northeastern part of the United States talks about a utility-only tax, and they've come to something close to what you were at, 40, 35 or 40 dollars a ton for carbon, and that's a utility-only, and I'm not sure that really gets us where we want to. We also believe that there shouldn't be a floor. We hope that there's a safety valve and there's a ceiling of some type. We think that bonus credits should be a part of this mix, as we do terrestrial sequestration. This part of the country, while we are heavily dependent upon coal, we also are heavily dependent on agriculture, and by minor changes in farming practices, we hope that we can generate some offsets by the farmers that own us, farmers and ranchers that own us, and we can hopefully buy our offsets from our own members. And given enough time and the right research and development funds, we believe that we can make progress on this. And so we want to be part of the future. Now, having said that, I want to close with this comment, and then what I'd like to do is maybe yield to either Scott Parsley or Vic Simmons from Rushmore and from East River, respectively, if they just had some closing comments on the co-op presentation here. Having said what we've said, we believe that we have been leaders in this with our Antelope Valley Station, Antelope Valley Power Station north of Beulah. We have captured carbon, and we are using it for EOR. We have engaged discussions with a carbon capture technology, which we had hoped to put on the back end of Antelope Valley Station, and we had also hope, and we also hope we can put on the back end of the Selby Station. And our members have also been leaders in efficiency and in conservation. I mean, again, envision a company that's owned by its members, and we have been leaders in efficiency. We've got most all of our co-ops have load management programs. We've got efficiency programs, and we've been leaders in both efficiency and conservation. So with that, Scott, did I miss anything, or Vic? Got it covered? With that, Mr. Commissioners and Mr. Chairman, I'll await your questions here. Now, how do I get out of here?
Great. Thanks very much. Our next three presenters will be providing a perspective from municipal utilities. Tom Marvin is the director of the South Dakota Municipal Electric Association. He's got quite a bit of experience in Montana, working for local governments, and was actually county commissioner in Montana. Along with him are Tom Heller, who's been the CEO of Missouri River Energy Services and has quite a track record of being a national leader on this issue, serving on some Blue Ribbon task forces and an appointment by Governor Mike Rounds to work with the Midwestern governors. Then you've got Mike McDowell, who's the CEO of Heartland, who has quite a broad array of management experience with associations as well as with load-serving entities, and we're very happy to have you three gentlemen with us. Thanks. Go ahead.
Dusty, thank you. I'm going to take off here briefly and then turn it over to our supplemental power providers. The South Dakota Municipal Electric Association is an organization of nonprofit municipal electric distribution utilities that serve about 100,000 South Dakotans. There are, in reality, I believe, 35 such utilities in the state. Of those, these supplemental power providers provide power to 31, I believe, East River providing power to two. I'm going to take a little different slant on this and deal with the current state of affairs that I think is relevant regarding the municipal electrics. We've had a decade-long drought, as you know, on the Missouri River, and it continues to restrict the supply of wholesale hydropower, which for the municipal utilities requires a continued purchase of higher-cost replacement power. This limited availability of hydropower, coupled with the ever-increasing operation and maintenance costs, and the higher costs of supplemental power have already left municipal officials with no choice but to enact recent and substantial retail rate increases. Despite these increases, for most of the last decade, our municipalities in general and South Dakota experienced good times. Disposable income, although below the national average, increased at a rate higher substantially than the increase in municipal electric rates, which still remain below the national average. And in 2007, South Dakota still ranked 44th in state and local tax burden. Unfortunately, given the current economy, I don't think many expect the next decade to be a repeat. The most immediate concern, aside from the level of acceptance of addressing global warming, and aside from the level of acceptance of the efforts to facilitate renewables, is the future cost of coal-fired generation that accounts for over half of the power supply for our municipal utilities. More exactly, I think it's right around 57%. Despite the best efforts of our supplemental power suppliers to keep wholesale rates down, the long-term consequences of impending federal legislation and regulatory action on CO2 emissions will inevitably result in pass-through costs from plant to municipality, leading to drastic rate increases, and for many municipalities affecting the funding for other basic services and infrastructure needs. I think there's another concern. I think there's a consensus that public policymakers have the best of intentions in place, but historically can bring about results that create economic displacement, and I think that's the key issue here. At this time, I would defer both to Tom Heller, Missouri River Energy Service, and Mike McDowell for their review of data and comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman Johnson, and Commissioner Colbeck, and Commissioner Hansen, and the ability to come and talk to you about an issue that's very, very important to us right now, and that of climate change. I've got several slides I'm going to go through rather quickly because I know our time is limited. We're getting to the time when we want to have some participation from the audience as well. Real quickly, Missouri River Energy Services has 60 municipal electric utilities. We're a wholesale power supplier. In South Dakota, we have 12. Those communities being such as Brookings, Pier, Vermilion, and Watertown. Steve Lehner from Watertown, South Dakota, is in the audience today with me. And the analysis that we performed, the resources that are included to that, our members have about, as Tom indicated, about 45% of their energy comes from hydropower, the WAPA hydropower. And the major or the direct resources that we have that are impacted or could be impacted by cap and trade program are Laramie River Station, which we're partnered with Basin Electric. The majority of our energy over and above those hydropower allocations for our members comes from that, plus Big Stone 2. We are going to be, if we get it built, we're going to be 25% owner of Big Stone 2 with Otter Tail and the other partners. Quickly, we were asked to do two things. Number one, we're asked to take a look at the President's budget proposal and the impact on our members and rates. We looked at the year 2015. The reason for that, Big Stone 2, we hopefully will have online by then. The thing that we looked at, though, is a political concern we have. We think, and we agreed with the speakers this morning, that politically it's going to be difficult to get 60 votes in the Senate. I think a way they can do it is to single out electric utilities. And if they single out electric utilities, you take a look at the revenues that are needed, that are required in the budget, the close to $80 billion. It's not rocket science to figure out what the cost per ton is. The cost per ton under that scenario, $35 per ton. Under that scenario, we're looking at a 65% rate increase from our members to our members with that scenario. The total dollars we're looking at, $33 million from just our South Dakota members to serve that we serve. City of Watertown specifically has a 60% increase in the year 2015, $13.6 million. Now, I think that there's a real big reason why we have fears that way. It was referred to a little while ago that the group in the Northeast, RGGI, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, several state initiative program that was put together, they are actively in a regional cap and trade. Electric utilities are the only ones in it. They've taken transportation out of the equation. They've taken industrial uses as well.
Sorry to interrupt. Just to make sure we're looking at the right numbers, are those last two bullet points, that's an annual?
That's an annual number, yes. Those are annual numbers in the year 2015. So the average impact on a retail customer in South Dakota, that's not up there, is 2.85 cents a kilowatt hour, or a little less than $300 a year. In the year 2015, average retail customer, a little less than $300 a year. The second thing we were asked to evaluate was the impact on our consumers from legislation. A little background on this, as Chairman pointed out, I've been asked by Governor Rounds to sit on the Midwest Greenhouse or Midwest Governors Association Greenhouse Gas Accord on the Advisory Committee. South Dakota signed on as an observer. They're not a participant, but they're an observer to see how the process is going. Now, I don't think there's any way that most of the people on that group believe a regional greenhouse gas accord could work, a cap and trade program. However, what I think the bigger goal is to try to influence federal legislation. And the influence federal legislation, you look at what does the Midwest have. The Midwest has a predominance of much higher, or a much higher predominance of coal generation, which means they're going to have much more CO2 emissions. With that in mind, we have been trying to influence one of the major things we've been trying to influence in that process is if the cap and trade program is put into place, who gets the allowances? Is it under an auction program? Or is it given the allowances, are they given to the electric utilities at no cost? With that in mind, the Joint Action Agency, similar to ourselves, have hired a consultant, Christensen and Associates, out of Madison, Wisconsin. And they will be releasing a study next week, and I have some preliminary results from that study to share with you right now. We've looked at two pieces of legislation. The cost per ton that we've looked at are the numbers that were talked about before, kind of the averages of the EIA analysis, the averages of the EPA analysis, recognizing that, wow, there's a lot of things there that could change, but we had to single in on something. So what we did is we looked at the year 2015, and the study has a whole range of costs all the way from 2012 to 2015. I used two different years. Under the Lieberman-Warner legislation, this is for the whole state of South Dakota, the electric consumers. $184 million under 100% auction it would cost electric consumers in South Dakota in 2015. That goes to nearly $400 million in 2030. Under the Boxer-Sanders Amendment to Lieberman-Warner, those numbers jump to almost $240 million in 2015 to over $500 million in 2030. Now, these are direct costs only. These are only the costs associated with coal emissions from coal plants. That doesn't include indirect costs. And indirect costs to us are the ones that Tom Marvin talked about. WAPA hydropower, they're going to have to go out on the market if the drought continues to buy replacement power. Wholesale prices are going to go up. That doesn't even include that. This doesn't even include the cost of natural gas increasing. Second thing we did is we looked at what happens if there's 100% allocation. The allowances that they're given to electric utilities at no cost, which we support the majority of them being given to us at no cost, what happens to South Dakota costs? Now, you still see a substantial impact, and the reason for that is because this is a cap and trade program. The cap is being reduced. It's at 2005 level, being reduced in 2015, being reduced down to 2030. I forget exactly what the number is. But we're going to have to go out and buy or buy allowances because we're not going to get them all for free. And with that, you can see the impact in South Dakota ranges under Lieberman-Warner from 30 to 173 in the year 2030, and Boxer-Sander from $46 million in 2015 to over $300 million in the year 2030. Mr. Chairman, I know I went through these rather quickly, but I think we're running up against the clock. So I'm just going to say we do have an active program working with our National Association and our lobbyists in Washington on trying to influence the legislation that's being passed. And the number one thing that we talk about with our delegation, you have to look at the impact on consumers. That has got to be the first thing you looked at. Look at realistic targets and who is going to be covered under this program, not just the electric utilities. All industry needs to be covered. And with that, I'll turn it over to Mike and let him finish up. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, thank you for the opportunity to present our views on the impact of greenhouse gas limitation legislation. We took a little bit different tack and did an analysis of what the President's proposals impacts would specifically be on our customers. Heartland, like Missouri River Energy, is a supplemental supplier of energy and power to communities in South Dakota, Minnesota, and Iowa. I want to specifically point out that we also provide power to several state agencies, including, on a supplemental basis, South Dakota State University and the University of South Dakota. I want to repeat a little bit what you heard from our first two speakers and emphasize a point in this. When technology is commercially available, our industry has already proven it can meet emission limits, providing, and this is important, and Steve Tomac alluded to this, that we have a clear national system in place and we have adequate time to implement that technology. At the current time, there is no commercial scale technology to capture CO2 emissions in existing coal-fired power plants, even though there is some very promising R&D underway, including some of the things that Basin Electric is doing. We can probably make this work, but we need to be very cognizant of what the cost of this is going to be. I'm not going to run through all of these bullets because of constraints on time, but based on what we know now, one cost that would be imposed based on current demonstration technologies, generation capacity would be reduced by 20 to 30% to power the equipment that's going to be necessary to capture CO2 and separate it from other emissions. You heard earlier that the EPA is moving forward to declare CO2 a pollutant. That would, in fact, present its own series of issues as to where you could actually store CO2, particularly in the use of injection wells into geologic formations. The cost to implement the technology that we're talking about is really not known. We can only speculate, and I'm not going to be here to speculate. I will tell you that based on the President's proposal to auction off all of the CO2 allowances, I call your attention to the graph there, the range of $8 to $60 a ton. The least impact would be 25% rate increase that we would have to impose immediately, and we're assuming, as the President did, that this takes place in fiscal year 2012. If the mean $40 a ton would actually be the result of the option, we would be looking at a triple-digit rate increase to be implemented almost immediately. These are all exclusive of any kind of hardware and storage that it would take to eventually comply with a cap-and-trade law that would begin to reduce the number of allowances that are available. I think it's worth throwing this up one more time. There is a disproportionate impact on the central and upper Great Plains, and there's the reason why. We are 76% of our electricity is generated with coal. Now, I used to lobby Congress, and there are reasons Congress does things and reasons that it doesn't do things. The chair people of the committees who are constructing the cap and trade program all come from regions who would be very minimally impacted by the transfer of money that would be required from electric consumers under a 100% auction program. Actually, the administration's proposal, if it were enacted into law, would turn electric utilities in South Dakota into tax collectors to pay for various other items in the federal budget. Unfortunately, it would not invest in the R&D that's critical to produce the hardware and the technology that would be required to meet CO2 challenges. There is a significant risk to electric reliability if we are required to cease using coal. Tom alluded to the partnership that we share with Basin Electric and the Laramie River Station. Electrons from that project flow throughout South Dakota. If the Laramie River Station were required to convert from coal to natural gas, the equivalent amount of coal energy required would be 2.4 times more natural gas than was used in the entire state of South Dakota in 2007. That would put LRS into a competing position for natural gas supplies against fuel for the production of crop fertilizer as well as ethanol, and you can use your own judgment as to what that would do to the price of natural gas in this area. Looking forward, it's Heartland's belief that affordable and reliable electricity and progress towards limiting greenhouse gas emissions are not necessarily incompatible. Energy efficiency and renewable resources can offset a portion of the cost to implement emissions limits. One of the speakers earlier emphasized energy efficiency. I will give you one area where you as consumers, and it's not the only area, need to think about what you do at home. An idle PlayStation consumes 1,500 kilowatt hours of electricity every year if you do not unplug it. That's one minor example of low-hanging fruit in terms of using energy more efficiently. The other part of this is, and this is where the President's program fails substantially, and that is we need significant R&D funding if cost-effective technology is going to be developed and deployed to limit greenhouse gas emissions. For you as policymakers, I think you have a challenge as well as an opportunity to provide input in this, and I think ultimately we have to find a way to keep electricity affordable and reliable, and that's the challenge as well as the opportunity that you have. And with that, I'll close, and I think there's probably some time for questions here.
Very, very good presentations. Lots of questions. We want to make sure we give the audience, the opinion leaders in the audience, some time to ask questions, too. So Commissioner Hansen is going to kick us off, and then we'll throw it out to all of you.
Thank you, Commissioner. And gentlemen, thank you very much for your presentations. Those were extremely sobering, if not in some cases frightening. I guess I'll share a little bit with you, and not be too lengthy on my question, but it appears that there are tremendous challenges with the proposed legislation. Let's assume, which I do, that there is a good reason to at least try to get to a point where we are using fossil fuels, fewer fossil fuels. Without buying into the climate change arguments or anything of that nature, we recognize that the Earth is a sphere hanging in space and that our fossil fuels are finite. So it's responsible on our part as stewards of this planet to try to move towards renewable fuels. Whether this is the way, which a huge tax on a portion of the people, which would force us into changing to other types of fuel resources other than carbon-based. At a 30,000-foot level, could you tell us then how can we get to that point where, as good stewards, we would use less carbon-based fuels, recognizing that there is a tremendous investment in carbon-based fuels at the present time? We can't just close plants and expect them somehow we're going to pay for them. How do we move towards that goal, if it's a worthy goal, which I believe it is, but it can't be just a switch we flip. And we'll start with any one of you. Tom?
Chairman and Commissioner Hansen, I think one of the obvious ways that was talked about earlier this morning by our speakers was the liberal use of offsets. That has to be part, I think, of the equation going forward, especially in the early years. In the first years of any cap and trade program, as it was talked about by some of the speakers, other speakers is that we don't have a commercial way of giving a PO to a contractor right now and having them clean up the emissions, CO2 emissions from a power plant. Basin Electric and others are working on that very actively, but it's going to be several years before we have commercially available the availability of doing that. So in those early years, we need to have, I think, liberal use of offsets. They need to be quantified, obviously. They can't be, as you would say, bogus things that are probably being done anyway. But I think that's one of the best ways that we can map a path forward is liberal use of offsets. And I think that can help South Dakota as well, as it was talked about, that the farm communities and others that can, through terrestrial sequestration, I think that will be very beneficial to the state of South Dakota.
Couldn't agree more. That's essentially the best answer.
That's essentially the best answer. Whatever proceeds derive are going to have to come back to the companies in order that we can protect the consumers. The only thing that we hadn't talked about today that I would add a little bit, and it's one of the probably more controversial elements, is that remember is that the United States is about 20% of the international emissions. China has just now surpassed us internationally. So there's been some conversation in Congress about off-ramps with the expectation being that if, in fact, the conditions don't lend themselves to us, or if, in fact, we don't reach treaty agreements, that if, in fact, we're the only ones in the world that impose this tax on ourselves at this time, that we have an opportunity to mitigate the effects. But offsets is the answer. Tom's right on point.
I appreciate the question, and if I understand it correctly, how do we get past how do we get to the point where we use less carbon-based fuels? And looking at that literally, I don't want to be argumentative, Commissioner, but do we want to get to less carbon-based fuels? And here's my point. I think we can use carbon-based fuels, but with the right amount of time and the right amount of R&D, we can continue to use carbon-based fuels. I mean, let's look at this country as a whole. It wasn't that many months ago we were in this oil crisis, and we were talking about a new energy plan and how we rid ourselves of our dependence on foreign oil. Part of the answer to that is coal. Like it or not, part of the answer is coal, and so we need to find a better way to use the coal, a more acceptable way to do that, and that helps our energy, domestic energy plan, as well as helps fuel our energy for the future. And so offsets are the transition, are the road to transition into something, but we need some serious R&D to figure out how we can use coal, which is the most plentiful domestic fossil-based fuel that we have in this country, and we need to figure out a way to use that in a more acceptable manner, if you will. It's a big picture, 30,000 foot answer.
I would just add that I completely agree with Steve. In order for us to have baseload reliability, we have to use coal, and any early movement away from that discourages the projects that are going on at Basin Electric and others to find ways to use coal more efficiently, as well as to separate the carbon in an effective and reliable way so that the rate shock to consumers is lessened to the extent that we can do that.
I think there's another issue that's a little more social in nature, and that's the cultural nature of the beast with regard to behavior. You saw recently the headlines in Brookings and the debate over their coal generation within their college community, and that's, I think, a big part of when Mike was referring to the low-hanging fruit. We all have a lot of that, I think. You can see that even in the lighting in this room right now. That's probably a little more than is necessary for our meeting. So that's a real long-term issue, but the cultural behavior of society has a dramatic influence on this.
Let's go ahead and toss it out, see if we can get a few good questions from the audience. Go ahead and raise your hand, and we've got a handheld mic. Yeah, Representative Solberg.
How does wind play into all of this? Wind energy.
No mic necessary for Daryl. Good job. Thanks.
And thanks for the question. I think all of us are in the position of where we're trying to capitalize on wind. Each of the investor owns has their own initiatives going on with wind. The challenge is the cost and the reliability. It's anecdotal, and I've heard the example, and I think that Jeremy has used it, that you know nobody wants to have surgery in a hospital that's powered by wind because the bottom line is that it's unreliable. It's absolutely part of the mix. And it's for that reason that everyone sitting up here is exploring it and investing significant funds in it. But you can't depend upon it. It's going to be a supplemental part of this answer. It's not going to be the primary part of the answer. Wind only works in complement with a base load. And the less cost the base load, the better for the equation. The least cost base load is coal. So coal and wind in combination is the ticket. You raise the price for coal or you replace it with natural gas and you've guaranteed the cost increase. Because wind by itself isn't the answer. It's part of the answer, but it's a intermittent part of the answer.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with what Steve just said. Wind and coal blended together are a very, very good fix for South Dakota. 20% of Heartland's energy comes from the Wessington Springs Wind Project. The anemometer data we have out there indicates that it will operate at peak efficiency about 50% of the time. That means the other 50% of the time we have to have a baseload power plant running to make sure that the lights don't flicker anywhere. So wind is important, but it is not the resource that we have to use to keep the lights on 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
The committee. I think the answer was excellent in terms of offsets and those kinds of things, but also a lot of us have done significant energy efficiency and conservation efforts to this point. And we think that if you're formulating a position, it would be worthwhile and helpful to us if within that position legislation looked at giving some, or at least compliance looked at giving some credit for the investment that our consumers have already made in energy efficiency and conservation.
Another question or two. If we get to a situation where you know we just can't build additional fossil fuel, or we'll just say coal generation, perhaps older plants, less efficient, dirtier, need to be shut down. And where does the power over the next 20, 30 years come from? You know, if we say we do just about as good as we can do at wind, 20 or 25%, we do really robust investment in efficiency. Maybe we can reduce load by 10%. That would really be a feat. If you got to shut down half the coal plants, where does the power come from?
Chairman, commissioners, I think a good example of the problems we've been having with that is the Big Stone 2 project. The project in Minnesota where we're trying to get transmission certificate of need and finally did succeed after 4 years in getting that. There was no question, though, that if we would have all went to Minnesota and had a gas plant on the other end of those lines and we would have asked for transmission lines, we would have got it right away. I think there is going to be a great movement towards natural gas, and prices are going to substantially go up. The problem with that, though, is natural gas emits 40 to 50% of the CO2 that coal does, but that to many policymakers, they seem to just ignore that. But I think there's going to be a tremendous amount of natural gas generation built. In addition to wind, when you start shutting down some of these coal plants.
I think I have a more or less of a general question. There's two problems that we kind of go back and forth on, same thing in the ethanol business: national security, climate change. If climate change is the problem we're talking about today, in considering all of the complexities here, nuclear keeps coming up as the answer. So if you're going to tax, at what level are you taxing electrical generation with fossil fuels before you reach the cost of a nuclear system? We have more nuclear plants than any other country in the world. They just happen to be floating in the Navy. So what is the cost of nuclear that would be the equilibrium?
There's two issues in play there. One of them is cost, but even if a carbon tax would reach the level that a baseload nuclear unit might cost, we have not built a nuclear baseload unit in this country in about 28 years. We have a regulatory system that has discouraged, if not outright prohibited, the construction of baseload nuclear. Had we followed the example of France, of all countries, our baseload electricity would be 80% nuclear, and our carbon footprint would be much lower than what it is. I can't let pass either, because I'm also a partner in the Big Stone 2 project. We have a clean air project up at Millbank that we can't get built because of the regulatory constraints that are in place.
But those same regulatory constraints, if I may, Chairman and Mr. Commissioner, to follow up on Mike's point, state of Minnesota has a moratorium on building nuclear plants. I know we have some representatives from Xcel Energy here that can talk about that at length. There's a bill that's been proposed, several bills that's been proposed to get rid of that moratorium. I heard that yesterday. That was defeated. Isn't that correct? So, you know, you can't build them.
If I could just add something to that, if I understand your question, and that is, at what cost does the CO2 get so high that it encourages to build nuclear? And I would suggest that it isn't an economic cost. It's a public perception cost. And until we can get over this public perception, I don't believe that we can build nuclear in this country. Yes, at some cost, that's going to start getting people thinking, and we can probably make it over the hump on that. But until we find the answer to an acceptable storage or some type of recycling or all of the other issues that surround nuclear, I don't believe that we can go there. Basin Electric has explored that, and it is fairly cost prohibitive at this point, but it's more of a public perception issue, I believe, than it is a cost issue.
Before people decide to haul the regulators outside and beat the hell out of them, I just would like to point out that the regulatory while regulatory lag is a problem in all jurisdictions, it is a bigger problem in Minnesota than perhaps in this jurisdiction.
Much bigger.
Other questions from the audience?
Just a little curious, with all the hydro development planned up in Canada, there hasn't really been much comment about that. And I'm wondering whether you have any thoughts about the role that both that and actually transmission, needed transmission, is going to play in however we address climate, either through moving renewables to market or through bringing down renewables from the north.
Transmission is a big element, and I know even in the Midwest Governors Association, there's several groups that are working, and one of the things that they're looking at is, how do you get transmission built to get renewable built? And it is a big problem. Specifically the hydro generation in Canada. I know that there's has been some environmental concerns, just like there have been with any project that have been built. But I think it's got to be part of the solution, and it should be part of the solution. It is carbon-free. Building transmission is I think, probably one of the biggest issues, as you know, we have today in the electric utilities. It's much more real than climate change legislation because it can't happen. We have some, in working in several states, as Xcel does, we have some states that have good regulatory processes, and we are sitting in one of them right now. We have other states that have very difficult regulatory processes, such as Minnesota. And CapEx, we're a partner in CapEx with Xcel Energy and Great River and others. That regulatory process is taking a tremendous amount of time, and even though there's no coal-based generation associated with those lines. So there's regulatory lag, not due to the great state of South Dakota, but due to others.
All I would add is that a diverse energy mix has to be part of the solution, that there's no single answer to this question. There's no silver bullet. It's not. It won't be natural gas. It won't be coal. It won't be wind. It won't be solar. The best public policy provision to take as regulators and as legislators and as congressmen is to accept the fact that it's going to be a multifaceted answer, because we're doing the best we can with regard to conservation and with efficiency, and we've made profound gains. But there isn't a scenario in the world that doesn't project energy increases to take place over the next 2015 to 2030. You're going to go up 1.5% to 2% a year going forward. You heard the Sony PlayStation example. Take a look at what your high-def TV draws. We demand it, and we've asked for it. So the solution is going to be multifaceted, eclectic mix of generation sources. And it's almost unfathomable to me that we're even having the conversation about taking 40% off the table, or 47% off the table, because coal is responsible for about half of that generation. So we can mitigate it, and we can manage a little bit, but to take half of the source off the table puts us in a position that we won't respond from it. But the answer is going to be all of the pieces. So let the industry catch up, give them the offsets, support the R&D. I think everybody understands the signal, because the only other thing we haven't talked about it, and Steve made reference to it a little bit, is that you've got a whole generation of plants that are due to be replaced, that are 30 and 40, 50-year-old plants, that this conversation not taking place is profound challenges. You've got a couple of companies that have done the right thing that are building a second plant that would reduce the emissions of the one that exists and can't get it done. So if this conversation wasn't taking place, the industry would be struggling with how to replace the plants coming forward, because you can't build nukes, you can't build coal, they're too expensive. Nuclear plant, I don't remember the price tag, but I think it's around $5 billion today, which is more than the market cap of most of the companies we've got that are out there. So there's no single answer, and we've got to replace a lot of plants going forward, and that problem's not going to go away. So don't take something off the table, I guess, what all I would add.
Thank you. My question is for Steve from Basin Electric. I grew up in the north central part of the state, the county that the next gen plant is being built in. Part of the state, rural part of the state, desperately needs that. Energy is economic development. I think it provides South Dakota with our best chance to replace with the decline in the number of farms. Energy projects are our best chance. But my question is, what is the exact status of NextGen, and do some of these proposals at the federal level imperil that project, and obviously future projects? But what's the exact status of NextGen?
Basin Electric has, a couple weeks ago, the board of Basin Electric voted to withdraw our loan application for the DOE loan guarantee, which was for a number of reasons. We are continuing to continuing to seek the permitting that's necessary to build a plant there, but our financing option, which was the DOE loan guarantee, was withdrawn largely because of a timing issue. And the timing was this, is the DOE loan guarantee required that we had to have in place the contracts for the CO2, which we were going to capture, put in the pipeline, and ship to the oil fields in western North Dakota, eastern Montana. We needed contracts in hand for that. We haven't gotten those yet and wouldn't have those in the timeline that it was necessary. There was the application fee of another $600,000 plus the $200,000 non-refundable for both of those are non-refundable. One, the $200,000 was for a Fitch rating, which was required. And then that just gets us through phase two. There were also eight other applicants, so the chances of us getting a 80% of a $4.6 billion loan guarantee seemed very remote. And we were just ahead of the curve on that one. So at that point in time, our board voted to withdraw our loan application. Still our intent to continue to move forward on the permitting process. We've got the land acquired. We are still on the ground working on the CO2 easements for the CO2 pipeline. Obviously, the projection date of 2015 has been moved back. And the other thing that entered into this, too, is our load forecast based on the current economy dropped a little bit for 2015-2016, and so it wasn't as critical that we put that in online at that point in time. I'm not sure if that fully answers your question, but that gives you an idea where we're at.
The biggest problem seems to be carbon sequestration for the coal plants. What is the research and development there? I mean, I know we're shipping some north to be used in the oil fields. You know, I've often commented, can't we just put it buried in a piece of metal somewhere so it can't get out? But I'm not a scientist, so I mean, where are we going with that? If we could sequester that or use it, you know, plants obviously use it, but is there a lot of study being done there? Because that would answer a lot of questions, I think, that people have.
There are R&D projects ongoing on several different fronts, and until we have a more definite knowledge of the results of those projects, we're not going to know which systems are going to work and which systems are not going to work. There is no silver bullet in injecting CO2 into geologic formations. If CO2 is classified as a pollutant, which EPA has announced its intention to do, current federal law requires what are called Class 1 injection wells. And those wells cannot be drilled where there's seismic activity or where they would impact aquifers that have drinking water in them. That puts a substantial part of the country off limits. That says nothing about the pipelines that would be required to transmit the CO2 once it's separated. So there are a number of issues that have to be resolved. I am aware even of some lab demonstration projects where the experiments are being run to actually separate the carbon and the oxygen atoms from each other, which would avoid some of the storage problems that I just alluded to. But we're a long ways away from knowing which technology is going to be best and which technology is going to work and which technology is going to be affordable.
Try this again. There we go. We'll make a couple of brief closing comments as commissioners. Before we do that, you know, let's thank our panel. You gentlemen did a wonderful job.
I'm going to just make some closing comments here. First of all, I'll just start it off. I think it's very obvious that we're all concerned as to what's going to happen. We're all unsure of what Washington's going to do, but I do feel today that I do have a little bit of a better handle on things. seeing the numbers is very sobering. It is something that we're going to have to address, and please know that we're as concerned as you are. So thank you all for coming. I appreciate your time, and I hope that the logical approach prevails. And as Tom Heller had mentioned, if we even do go to natural gas, I've heard estimates that we'll actually be right back where we started in about 9 years, because we're going to cut about 50% of the CO2 out, replace it with natural gas, and in 10 years we'll be exactly where we are today. So I don't think that's a viable fix either. It's a tough situation, but as was mentioned earlier, we do have our representatives here, Ben Reedy and Matt, from Senator Johnson's office, so hopefully we'll stay in close contact with them, and we can get something accomplished. But most of all, thank you very much for being here today.
Well, first, I would like to say thank you to Chairman Johnson and Commissioner Colbeck for leading the charge on this and putting this together. Certainly, staff does a tremendous amount of work, but I'm not sure where the idea came from, but not from I received the email after they were working on it, and I appreciate their leadership in putting this together. I'd also like to say thank you to all of the participants. Karen, you did a real good job fielding some challenging questions there, and the information that we received here today was just extremely important. I think it's very, very important that we deal with facts, that we deal with the science and technology, as opposed to dealing with politics and emotion. And I think that's what we had here today, and I sincerely appreciate that. Lastly, I'd like to make a commercial, and that is that on May 11, 12, and 13 in this building, in this facility, the Public Utilities Commission will host a conference. That conference is entitled, Crisis or Renaissance, the State of Energy in America. We will have presentations on all of the traditional fuels. We will also have presentations on, I'd like to say, all renewables. I think there's about 14 or 15 presentations totally. A little bit on cap and trade, a little bit on transmission. It should be an all-encompassing, very interesting presentation. We did it once before in 2005. It was very successful. We had the FERC chairman there. The FERC chairman is invited again, and we're trying to get him to make presentations. So I hope that you can all attend that. We have, at this point, two primary sponsors for that conference. Xcel Energy has agreed to be a primary sponsor, Northwestern Energy. Thank you, Pam. And appreciate it if you folks can, May 11, 12, and 13, participate in that.
I'll just offer up four thoughts before we adjourn. The first is, I think it's really interesting and important to know that, I mean, no one today argued for an action, for inaction. I mean, this was really a pragmatic discussion and presentations on how do you find a common sense solution, which leads into point number two, and that is that there are real costs from these proposals. And to Mr. Willard's point, I don't think we want to try to gloss over them. These facts are really important, and transparency is vital in this conversation. If we are in a hurry to do something and in an effort to sell it, we don't have a serious conversation about the cost, then we're doing our country a disservice. Let's find out what the reality is. Point number three would be that, and the reason this conversation is important, is that we have seen that the flavor of the regulation matters greatly. And depending on what could pass Congress, you could have a proposal that is manageable, or you could have a proposal that is really devastating to the people who ultimately are paying the bills. And so that's where the interest from the commission comes in. Let's work with our congressionals, let's work with associations, constituency groups involved in D.C. so we can make sure the flavor of that regulation is one that makes sense. And finally, just to give you an idea of where we're all headed from here, we are going to have staff take the, you know, these presentations were nice. Frankly, they were only a fraction of the information that all of the load-serving entities in South Dakota worked very hard to put together. Lots of information that the commission staff will be digging through, trying to synthesize, trying to push and probe a little bit so that hopefully before too very much longer, we can release some sort of a short analysis of what we believe the most likely impacts on ratepayers would be. And again, as economic regulators, we're very much concerned about that. So I'll echo my colleague's call for thank you for the attendees and the presenters. And at that point, we'll stand adjourned. Thanks.